Good very early morning, and welcome to Radio Estina. I'm Alex Linder, your host, here to guide you through the wee hours. And I swear to God, I'll try to be more interesting than those boring-ass all-night country music radio goofballs they have out there if you're on the road. Anyway, what we're going to talk about today are threefold, and I've just been reading a little Libido Dominandi. Now we're going to play some new music you haven't heard before. And sometimes it's not as lively early at night, but I just took a little nap. I'm awake. We're going to go for at least 2 hours here. It's 2 a.m. in the middle of the country, 3 a.m. on the East Coast, midnight on the West. We're going to talk about three things today. First, we're going to conclude our discussion of the difference between white nationalism and paleoconservatism. We've been discussing a thread over at Chronicles. Then we're going to talk about journalism as it relates to humans versus as it relates to animals through the study of invasive species in the self-proclaimed great state of Texas. And I think you'll find that interesting. Also, we're going to talk about, to conclude, and you know we go into each of our subjects in depth, something I've been reading up on lately, very interesting, the relation between Jews, Nazis, and homosexuals, the interrelations there, as unearthed and dissected by some of our traditional Catholics, that the same Jews and homosexuals lump in with Nazis. So it's kind of like an Escher drawing. Everything weaves in and out. But as an executive summary, what the traditional Catholics claim is that the Nazis who came to power in Germany represented a butch faction of homosexuals that did war with and overcame the femme faction centered around the Jew Magnus Hirschfeld, who formed an institute for the study of sex and basically tirelessly promoted homosexuality for about 30 years from 1900 until shortly before the turn of the century, until the Nazis took power. Kicked his sorry ass to France. Well, actually, he fled there a couple of years before, and then they busted down the doors of his institute and seized his papers. But this was perhaps a Jew who single-handedly turned Germany from a Jew-accepting country into a Jew-despising country, a revolution in approach and mentality that is very much needed in America and which has the same source to draw from. Anger over faggot prop. We've talked about California and the laws it's passed, but we'll get into this a little later. We want to start, as I said, with the discussion at Chronicles. Now, before we do that, I'm going to play a couple of songs, and I want to thank all the people who donate the songs to me. And I try to play, I guess, more of an 80s guy. That's when I came of age, so I don't like classic rock from the 70s. You can hear that in other shows. Stan plays some of that. Other people play some of that. You're not going to hear any classic rock here. I'm not into Zeppelin. I don't like much Stones. I don't like much Who. What you're going to hear here from me, if I play older stuff, is going to be more 80s. General Public, Duran Duran, a lot more. I find Duran Duran wears fairly well, actually, surprisingly enough. But mostly what you're going to hear from me is new stuff that's slightly obscure that you haven't probably heard before, but it's short and upbeat generally. And now and then we might have stuff that's more melancholy. In fact, tonight, because we're in the wee hours, I'm going to probably play a little more melancholy stuff than I would normally. But let's see. It looks like all of our monitors are going well, and hopefully this is being recorded without incident, and we shouldn't have too much disruption going with the forum. Let's see here. And as always, we encourage you listening to join vnnforum.com, where whenever our radio is on, you'll see the indications of that. And we always keep a show thread in the This Just In stickied up top. And then when these are done, they're archived within hours of conclusion. And you can download the MP3 and put it on your MUVO player or whatever kind of player you have, your iPod, as are all of our shows are done like that. But I specifically maintain a detailed notes and links section for the stuff I'm talking about for each broadcast, and there's one thread for each year that we've done the show. We started last year, so this is year two. And that is in at vnnforum.com. You go down to our activism section, and under Vanguard Broadcasting, you'll find Radio Istina. I like to say every show that Istina is the opposite of Pravda. Pravda is the ideological truth. Istina is the Russian word for the real truth, the factual truth, the street-level reality truth. The truth at the end of your nose, to take Orwell's formulation. So, I thank everyone who sends me music, and there are a number of you who do. If you have a song or two you might like to hear, send it to me, and I'll probably play it. Little note to the wise, Warren Zevon is a Jew. Now, I play some black artist, and I'll even play a Jew artist if I like the song. I don't care that much. It's not that big of a deal. We don't have to be ideological purists about stuff like that, where listener reaction is more or less the criterion that matters when it comes to art. But let me tell you what I got to do. I got to do one little thing here. What I'm going to do is play for you a couple of songs, just two songs, and then we'll be back and we'll start in with the Chronicles thread. And I think that what should I play? Let's see here. First, I'm going to play a song by UB40 that I really like called Red Red Wine. And then I'm going to play another song that I would bet that 99.9% of you have never heard, called Ashamed by Deer Tick. Both pretty good songs. Anyway, two songs and then we're back. Here we go. It's up to you.
red wine, you make me feel so fine. You keep me rocking all of the time. Red, red wine, you make me feel so grand. I feel $1 million when you're just in my hand. Red, red wine, you make me feel so sad. Anytime I see you go, it make me feel bad. Red, red wine, you make me feel so fine. Monkey packing with the panda sweet red wine. Red, red wine, you give me holy for zing. Holy for zing, you make me do my own thing. Red, red wine, you really know how to love. You're kind of loving like a blessing from above. Red, red wine, I love you right from the start. Right from the start, with all of my heart. Red, red wine in a 80s style. Red, red wine in a modern beat style. Yeah. Give me a little time, let me clear up my mind. Give me a little time, let me clear up my mind. Give me red wine, the kind, let me feel fine. Let me feel fine, all of the time. Red, red wine, it make me feel so fine. Monkey packing with the final sweet devil. Till I die, and that's no lie. Red, red wine can get you on my mind. Wherever you may be, I'll surely find. I'll surely find. Make no fuss, just a little fuss.
On high, and I started for the town that front yard died.
All right, that last little two-minute ditty there was Ashamed by Deer Tick. Before that, we heard Red Red Wine by UB40. And as I said, we're going with a little mellower tunes tonight, as it's the wee hours here. But now we'll talk about something that's interesting and controversial, and that is, what do we do from where we are in America today? And the respectable right, so defined, I argue, by its refusal to criticize Jews. That's what makes it respectable. When you stop talking about what matters, you become respectable. If you talk about what matters, you persist in talking about what matters and discussing who actually runs the country, you become unrespectable, disrespectful. And so, because the topics that matter most are always the topics that end up being circled around back to, race is a perennial problem at the paleoconservative sites. And to the extent that they allow untrammeled debate, it becomes clear that white nationalists dominate. They not only dominate Jew sites, they dominate liberal sites, they dominate conservative sites alike, because all those things, all non-white nationalist media are essentially liberal media, because they all accept the tacit premise, which is also the big lie, that race does not matter. That race does not exist, that humans are fungible. You know, earlier today when I was preparing another archive at viennainforum.com, of which we have many, in particular the one on media criticism, I was dressing up a thread on the New York Times, and a fine writer named Christopher Donovan for the Occidental Observer. You can read his pieces at theoccidentalobserver.com, or you can read the ones I've reposted in vnnforum.com under media criticism. And the New York Times has moved warily into blogs, not just blogging, but allowing people to respond to them. And that's what really makes it a little bit frightened, because some of the reality comes through. And the guy talking about these new changes at the New York Times, cited in the article by Christopher Donovan at the Occidental Observer, very proudly mentions how he got a comment canceled from the New York Times blog that now allows the public to comment. What did he get canceled? Why, it was a comment from Ray in the Mexican colony of L.A. talking about Mexican day laborers outside of Home Depot just pissing in public. And that's the kind of reality that the big Jew media, of which there is none bigger than the New York Times, does not want to intrude into the carefully concocted dream world they prepared for their fellow Jews and for the rest of us stupid cattle. The dream world in which race doesn't matter. Well, except for Jews being superior and being racist in Israel, race doesn't matter. But race doesn't matter for whites who want to protect themselves. And that's why when the Jewless Negroes murder Americans, like Lauren Burke, like Eve Carson, the murders are never put in context. But when you allow public response over blogs, then people become aware of the context. People aren't that stupid, as they may seem, as the Jews may think. That's why they have to suppress us. They may think we're stupid, but they know, in fact, they need to suppress what we're talking about by very pointed, very legal maneuvers. So, going back to the Chronicles thread, and let's see here. I've got a bunch more music I'm going to play. Who knows? Sometimes it's kind of nice to talk in the middle of the night instead of the middle of the afternoon. There's not so much ambient noise. People racing around and yipping outside. Let's see. What have we got here? We have a very good comment I'm going to read in just a second, and let's see. Okay, now we went through the Chronicles thread up to post 100, and the link, of course, is posted in VNN in the show chat thread, or the show thread in the forum, and we covered the first 100, first 99, and these are at the bottom of a column by Pat Buchanan about the actual facts of what went on in Jena, which was basically that whites put out some nooses to kind of prank their white friends. And then later, months later, in an unrelated incident, niggers gang attacked a white and beat the hell out of him. Buchanan gives you the full facts of the matter, whereas the controlled media covered it up. Of course, Buchanan doesn't give you the essential part, which is that blacks were kept in segregated communities in America when America used to be free, when it had free association. That's the part only white nationalists will give you, and paleoconservatives will not give you, because they want to pretend it's all a matter of region or culture rather than race. And that's directly what's being contested here in their letters page. And the two heavies at Chronicles, that would be Clyde the Goat Wilson and Tom Flemio Fleming, get the worst of it. Here's an excellent comment from someone named Prosium. I don't know who that is. I thought it was one person. I might be wrong. Whatever. He goes by the name Prosium when he comments on the paleoconservative blogs, both Talkie Mag and Chronicles. He says, in all fairness, the modern architect of white nationalism was Senator Thomas Bilbo, Democrat from Mississippi, who advocated the deportation of the Negro to Africa in Take Your Choice, Separation or Mongrelization. Bilbo spent most of the late 30s, early 40s trying to persuade Congress to support his plan. So he's saying either separate the races or they'll mongrelize, and that's what multiculturalism, the hope and the legal decree that whites become mongrels while Jews protect their race and their DNA. The better to rule over the rest of us they've divided and conquered. The idea that America is a white man's country and should remain that way indefinitely has been floating around for centuries, although only recently has a movement emerged out of it. Jefferson, in his notes, wrote about deporting the Negro to his quote-unquote native clime. Madison and Monroe were involved with the American Colonization Society. That was to recolonize the blacks in Africa. In the 1790s, there was a strong movement in Virginia to resettle Negroes abroad. Free soilism had strong white nationalist overtones. Wilmot advised himself as the champion of the white working man. His famous proviso was about preserving the West for the white race. Lincoln, as you know, was in favor of deportation. Jefferson Davis had similar thoughts in his memoirs. He wanted to ship them to Latin America. During the late 19th century, John Tyler Morgan, Democrat from Alabama, senator, toyed with the idea of resettling the Negro in the Belgian Congo and supported the Protestant missionaries in Africa like William H. Shepard to advance this agenda. So all these 19th century, 18th century heavyweights were of accord when it came to the Negro. He was not like us. He was different from us. He was so radically removed from our society and our ways and our kind that he needed to be resettled, lest his kind disrupt and destroy us. Historically speaking, white nationalism in its various incarnations has never been a southern or a northern idea. It was least popular in the extremes, in the lower South, where the labor needs of its plantation-based economy, and in New England, where it was criticized on moral grounds. It tended to fall on fertile soil, white nationalism that is, in the upper South, border states, and border North, a belt of states that stretched from Virginia to Missouri. Which is right. I mean, my ancestors in southern Illinois and in Missouri, they did not want blacks brought into these areas, and they did battle with the abolitionists. The revolutionary changes to immigration law, federal civil rights reform, and the spread of television has nationalized the race issue in a way that wasn't the case previously. Northern and southern racial attitudes have converged significantly since the end of segregation. There are now northerners who sound like southerners on race and vice versa. The South has imported some of the worst aspects of the North: evangelical Christianity, supercapitalism, democratic fundamentalism, anti-racism, etc., and been deformed by them. Northerners who finally get the race question should be applauded for doing so and welcomed as allies. They are certainly less of a threat to our interests than the McCain voters, which we are producing domestically. And of course, McCain would have his base in the South Carolinas and the Bible Belt, sweeping across the South and the Midwest, where people are essentially patriotardic. They think they're patriots, but they have no idea who they're actually swearing allegiance to. So that's an excellent, very eloquent comment on the history of white nationalism and what it meant to American heavyweights before the 20th century, in contradistinction to that which is being asserted incorrectly by the likes of Clyde Wilson, who wants to pretend that Northerners are the problems. He says overtly, we discussed last time, that there is no Negro problem. The root of the problem is the Northerner. Not true, though. Okay, moving on. Let's see. Let's check our sound. All right, we should be about at the right levels here. I never want it to be too low. Well, we had last time, we had the debate over, if you may recall from the earlier show, the number one guy at Chronicles is Thomas Fleming, and he's a PhD, and he reads classics, and he lectures in it. And he said, in so many words, that white men don't whine in response to someone who was telling him about anti-white discrimination, which, if you know Fleming, all he does is whine when he talks. It doesn't matter. He's whining about fast food. He's whining about this. He's whining about that. I mean, whining is the same as analyzing something critically, isn't it? He said, don't whine. How can you not whine about laws that materially damage your existence and through you, that of your family and your kids? You'd be crazy not to, what he calls, whine about that. I mean, what else is politics if not protecting yourself and your kind from being preyed on by others? Preyed on by others whose most devious means is using the television to persuade us we don't even exist. We're just motley random individuals. Black has black pride. Mexican has La Raza. The Jew has 150,000 organizations. What does the white have? He has nothing. He has the chance to be killed in a carjacking like Eve Carson. Raped and murdered like Shannon Christian or Chris Newsom. Where does the white have an organization that is fighting for his specific racial interests? How can every race but whites have interest and whites not? It must be in the interest of another group to claim that, because it's logically absurd on the face of it. Until you fight. You know, someone had an excellent line on a VNN forum. I don't know who originated it, but what was it? Breed like a spick. I can't remember the other part of it, but the other part was there was a triplet. It was what was it? Bitch like a nigger, breed like a spick, whine like a Jew, something like that. I mean, that's what it comes down to. The one who's willing to go lower is the one who's going to win. If we're so high-minded and fair and individualist and worried about others, we're going to be replaced by those who aren't, who only care about their own group. I mean, that's La Raza's slogan. For those inside the race, everything. For those outside the race, nothing. This is a group that's been saluted by relatives of our President George Bush. What do Jews say? They say, we are the chosen of God and everybody else is an animal. What do blacks say? Well, they don't have any basis from which to conclude they're superior, so they just make it up that we were invented by evil scientists who bred out lighter and lighter skinned blacks until finally they were white. I mean, well, that's what poor Calypso Louie is reduced to contending. Of course it's ridiculous, but the point isn't that it's ridiculous. Most things are ridiculous. The point is that it's a way of polarizing and galvanizing so that we know who we are and we know that they are our enemy. And that's what the point of this show is, to teach you who you are and who your real enemy is, who is the person who is afflicting your community. And ultimately, although there are a lot of proximate causes, the ultimate cause is the Jew. You know, you're the Mexican gangbanger spraying up your neighborhood, attacking white kids, whatever, murdering people. Okay, that's a direct cause of the problem. What's the indirect cause? Well, it's the immigration policy that let him in. Well, who's responsible for the immigration policy? Well, you go investigate that. What you'll find in country after country, controlled by ostensibly white-faced people, is that the people in charge of immigration are Jews. The ones advocating multiracial immigration policy, as opposed to white policy, whites-only policy, are Jews. The ones running these departments are Jews. The ones subsidizing the people destroying us are Jews. The Jew is the cause of all these other problems. Crime problem, race problem. No, Jew problem. Jew problem is what we have. Let's see. Prosium again chips in. I don't think racialists are perplexed at all about the causes of our current predicament. Racialists alone have correctly diagnosed what is ailing America, liberal capitalist democracy, and have prescribed innovative solutions for combating this problem. Nowhere else is LCD itself openly called into question on the American political spectrum, that is, saying that the dollar is more important than the people. Hitler said the state is a vehicle for protecting the race, rather than protecting the income of the oligarchs, the hyper-rich who run the country, and most of those hyper-rich are Jews. The mainstream conservative movement is for all of these things, he says. All the things that are causing the problems. In fact, movement conservatives are for exporting this disease abroad to Serbia and Iraq in the belief that this modern sickness, Yankeeism or Americanism, is what makes America such a great place to live. Christianity is not the answer either. The church is also comfortably reconciled to the status quo, and not least because it has these 501c3 restrictions on its activities. So it can't get too far from the orthodoxy laid down by the Zionist-controlled government, or it loses its tax status and has to start paying taxes. Appealing to the Southern tradition isn't enough. I come from the deepest part of the South, and what remnants of that tradition still exist there are being eroded away by the acid of consumerism and liberal ideology. There is zero understanding of constitutional republicanism amongst this democratic mob. Even college-educated Americans struggle to identify Iraq on a map of the world. Any student in the classics knows how democracy ends. If that is what it takes to whip this country into shape, so be it. Concluding his remark, Prosium. And let's see, there should be a few more good comments in here at certain points. Here's an interesting point, and this is the neat thing about the web. It allows, you know, intelligent individuals to post and create content that the state-controlled journalists, and that means basically anybody who's writing for any paper you can buy on the newsstand, will never put into their stories or will have edited out. And most of them know the party line well enough that they would never stick anything unsemitically correct into their stories in the first place. But this guy makes a point that reader says, blame who you will, but today in Charleston, South Carolina, the blacks want a monument to Denmark Vesey, who supposedly wished to kill off all the whites. And see, that's something that I had not heard or not seen. And that shows you that blacks in America are just like blacks in South Africa. As soon as they accede to political power, they get rid of all the monuments to the great white men of the past and replace them with their own Jew-cultivated and Jew-created, really Jew-produced, bogus heroes like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. You may not know that Rosa Parks was actually a communist operative and that her famous refusing to yield her seat was in fact a planned event. Not the day that it happened, but the event itself was planned. So things are quite not as they appear. Just as in school, they will teach your kids, they will have them read To Kill a Mockingbird, in which a little nigger, is falsely accused of rape, and a heroic white liberal defends him and gets him off. But what they'll never tell you in a public school, which promulgates the state religion of diversity, is that every year 40,000 white women are raped by niggers. Just like the little nigger in To Kill a Mockingbird. And so we're living in a system that genocidally conduces us toward a cliff off which we're going to drop, and has a sing all the way along. Someone informs me that Prosium is the drug in the movie Equilibrium. I guess it's like a Prozac. Okay, I remember. I've seen that movie. Now, that was That was kind of a $200,000 budget knockoff on an Orwell theme, a 1984 theme, or a Fahrenheit 461 theme, where everybody's forced to be exactly the same. I recall that. You know how they have on the science fiction channel, they run all kinds of low budget horror movies. Well, this was not a horror movie, but it was in a science fiction dystopia, low budget science fiction movie. So prosium was the drug used in that. Thanks for letting me know. I had forgotten that, even though I've seen the movie, which is mediocre but worth watching. Let's see. And we're working our way through the comments here up to about... ...111. Here's an interesting side comment on Asians. But it's not something that you see too often. He says... This guy says... I have no hostility towards Southern people. As a white nationalist, I want to see the resources of America devoted to developing the engineering, scientific, and medical talent that resides in the brains of Appalachia's youth, rather than on developing the Chinese youth. China's youth are being developed for engineering, medical, and scientific careers within the borders of America. This is a disgrace and a major scandal. And that's true. If you look at, there are huge percentages of these grad school slots that are going to non-Americans. And they're also brought in on H-1B. And who pays the price for that? Well, the other people who are technically and genetically talented enough to hold those positions are white males. They're the ones being discriminated against in favor of third world nationals. He says, I am shocked this hasn't been covered in Chronicles by someone like Roger McGrath. Native-born white Americans are being forced to subsidize their racial and economic dispossession. The Chinese must think we are fools. They can't possibly have any respect for us. Pat Buchanan's most recent book is a failure for not addressing this issue. If Pat had addressed this issue, the issue would be discussed on the Lou Dobbs Show by now and other mainstream media venues. Pat fired a big dud. And on and on. So he berates Tom Fleming and Pat Buchanan for not covering the opportunity cost of not educating white American male youth in exchange for educating the Chinese, who already have over a billion people and could well be our enemies. I say 461. Oh, Fahrenheit 451. And, you know, we have, I always like to hype this because I've spent a lot of time putting it together. We have a free speech archive. It's called Speech Martyrs. It's in the This Just In. It's a sub-forum. And in there we list all the people who are persecuted for speaking their minds, which is illegal in most countries outside America, because the Jews have concocted a concept called hate speech that criminalizes speech they don't like, that is, speech which points out their agenda and how their behavior and their words benefit Jews and hurt whites. In other words, what I'm telling you right now. And they have thrown all kinds of men in prison. I mean, people in Canada have been jailed for writing letters to the editor or quoting Bible verses or quoting crime statistics on forums in foreign countries. That happened to Tom Winicki, posting in our forum, VNN forum, was thrown in jail for pointing out that minorities are committing most of the crime in Toronto. And he did that on an American board, VNNforum.com, and got thrown in jail for it. Americans don't realize this because it isn't talked about. The only time free speech becomes an issue is when people get angry at something a Jew writes, and the Jew gets a little bit of backlash for it, as with the Jew Fleming Rose in Denmark. See, they never told you he was a Jew. He prints a blasphemous cartoon of Muhammad, or an offensive cartoon, an insulting cartoon, and the Muslims rise up, as the Jews knew they would, and it becomes a free speech issue. But when whites criticize Jews, or the system Jews have created, or the results of that system, the whites are thrown in jail in country after country, and not just in Canada, not just in Australia and France and Germany, but in England also. Saw a guy the other day named Worrell, and, you know, the reporter writes, you know, just a matter of fact, if it's a natural cell, he had, you know, right-wing material in his house. And not describing it, saying, you know, this is the reason he was picked up and is now currently in jail. He had other stuff, but he also had illegal political material. That's no different than Ray Bradbury's 451, where if you had a book, they would come to your house and just burn it. Because what do you think they do with this illegal political propaganda? They have to destroy it. So the same people who mock the Germans for burning Jewish books they acquired legally are themselves burning books as official organs of the state that they don't like and won't allow anyone else to have. The Germans didn't bust people for having illegal political material, but today's English do. And they'd like to make it that way in America also. All right, now we have another comment by Clyde Wilson, who's the number two heavy at this little outfit called Chronicles, which is probably the original paleoconservative magazine. Paleocons being the people who used to be the mainstays of conservatism as people and as thinkers until the Jews came into conservatism in the 60s and 70s and had triumphed over the paleocons by the early 80s. Because the Jews are better organized, and any group that does not explicitly exclude them is going to fall victim to their superior money-raising abilities and networking abilities if it lets them in. They will come to dominate because they work as a team, whereas whites are individuals. That's, after all, the source of the macro problem as well as the micro problem of internal conservatism. See if he says anything worth saying. He says, no, he doesn't in that. This guy says, another guy says, why bother answering the disingenuous prattle posted by I Am Not Spartacus and others? Whether the non-whites are consciously working against us isn't a consideration, his blather about non-white church-going brothers aside. They are being used as tools against us and receiving favored treatment in all areas by a government run by those who hate us. Race is a huge factor in everything. Otherwise, the Genesis 6 incident and the article above would never have come about. Referring to Pat Buchanan's description of what actually happened at Jena. Racist? Who cares? No matter what a white man says to defend his people or actions against predatory and deceitful Marxists and non-whites, he's called racist. Argue about the Civil War all you'd like. The trolls have got you running and looking in every direction except straight ahead. Whites need to think and act as a collective group, just like everyone, just like every other ethnic group out there, especially, gasp, Jews, so many of whom go out of their way to deny their cohesiveness, ethnic cronyism, and disdain for the other, for the West especially. So the Jews run the white West, and they hate the white West, so they're destroying it by electing a new people. And in the transition period, passing laws that discriminate against the majority, and denying that the majority even exists as an identifiable group with interests worthy of protection. And this is one of the differences. I Am Spartacus responds, I did forget to mention our parish had a Muslim family of nine convert last year. How are you and yours doing vis-a-vis the Great Commission? The blather you describe is all throughout the New Testament. What is not in the New Testament is anything resembling your desire. And this is the problem of a lot of the... kind of where the rubber meets the road. Is race more important than religion, or is religion more important than race? And for the Catholic traditionalists and the other Christians who say that religion is more important, they are able to ignore a lot of evidence is the most charitable way to put it with regard to their position, because the truth is that no matter what wisdom you think Jesus spouted, it won't overcome biology. You can't turn a nigger into a human being by preaching to him, any more than you can turn a nigger into a human being by feeding him a pill or rubbing some lotion on his leg. A nigger is a different being than a white. He's not really a white person who just doesn't happen to have enough money, or who just wasn't raised by the right people, or wasn't raised in the right environment. He is a different creature entirely. And that goes for the Jews too. And the fact that I need to say this shows you what a unique animal humans are, and how easily they can be fooled. Anyone can look at different breeds of dogs and see they're not the same damn thing. Even if they can interbreed, they're still not the same thing. A German shepherd is not the same as a dachshund. So it is with niggers and with whites and with Jews and with Asians and Mexicans. They're not the same thing. but you'll find many Christian fantasists at the paleoconservative sites. Let's see. The interesting thing here is that until the rise of the internet and the rise of white nationalism, all there were out there that people could look to were organs of opinion like Chronicles. And so to whatever extent race was covered, it would have been covered in those organs. And the one guy who talked about it some was Sam Francis. And although the editor of the journal, Fleming, says that they still cover it, in effect, they really don't. And you can find it much better covered at VNN and a dozen other places than you can in the Chronicles crowd. And they shy away from it because it's dangerous and they don't want to undercut their own funding and whatever crumbs of respectability they get off the mainstream Jewish table. They're the dog under the table, and they get a few crumbs, and they're allowed to stay there and lick their master's feet. Whereas those who dare to go the whole way and say, look, the problem with America is it's run by Jews, and Jews are an ethno-narcissistic group that hates every other group and divides and conquers them as best it can. And the only way to defend yourself against the Jews is to point out who they are and who you are and attack them directly and say, they are not us, we don't need them, we want them out of our land, out of our country. That's the way to go about it. That's what the Nazis discovered. And we'll talk a little later about how, even though they may have had homosexuals in their ranks, they used the Jewish identification, the identification of the Jew with cultural Bolshevism, as they called it, homosexuality in particular, moral decadence in particular, in general, they tied the Jew to, and you know, I'm giving you examples from Weimar Germany. You can come up with just as many here today in America. Bratz dolls, come up with by an Iranian Jew, marketed by Jewish retailers. Focus on homosexuality, and Jews are completely behind that. We'll talk about that later more, though. Interesting, the guy who wrote earlier what I read before it was responded to as blather by the Christian says, as if you actually care. You're playing an old game, a very old game, but it doesn't work as well on the net, does it? It is certainly is wearing out on the masses, although they aren't fully aware of just what's wrong yet. That's why your screechings are becoming more and more strident. And this is the claim that, you know, all you got to do is convert these niggers to becoming Christians. That's one version. Or all you got to do is get the incentives of the welfare state right. That is, quit subsidizing black bastardy and single motherhood and housing, and you'll force niggers to get jobs, and then they'll shape up and become just like regular people. All these things are the lies being put to them, not only by reality, but by the ability of people to discuss reality through the internet instead of having to go through the letters page of their dead tree magazine or paper. And this guy makes some interesting points, and something I didn't know about Fleming, which may explain his attitude. This guy says, oh, and another thing, I will not stand idly by and let the ex-civil rights marcher Fleming, once a leftist, always a leftist, I bet Sam Francis never marched with Negroes against his own people, irrelevantly insult that brilliant and courageous scholar, Professor Michael Levin, a Jew, a man rigorously committed to telling the truth who has suffered for his integrity. That's true. He's written a good book about feminism, and he has been attacked for it. Levin's magnum opus on race, Why Race Matters, is so clearly the best book ever written on the public policy implications of gene-based interracial differences in ability and temperament that it hardly seems worth saying so. Of course, the thing about Levin is he won't discuss the Jewish role, and to say role is to understate it, the Jewish direction of the mixing of the races socially, politically, and legally. He writes about the implications of the policy, but he doesn't tell you who put the policy in place, who advocated it for decades until it became law. And that's the crucial part of it. But he is good on symptoms, like the rest of the Jewish Amren crowd is on race and crime. They give you the symptoms, but they obscure the disease. Unlike the embarrassingly petulant Fleming, we conservative racialists, there are also non-conservative racialists, a very different breed, are almost always true gentlemen in the Anglo-Saxon mold, even those of us descended from other ethnicities. It is therefore right and proper to do for Dr. Fleming what he refuses to do for us, namely, accord proper respect where it is due. And this again is characteristic of the character of the paleoconservatives. If they can shit on people and get away with it, they will. And that is usually taken, you know, what's the measure of a character of a man is how he treats those who can do him no good, or those who are in no position to help him or hurt him. And the people in the controlled media, of which Chronicles is surely a part, treat those who they deem farther to their right, or Nazis, or racist, as people they can shit on at will. Because we can't, they think, threaten their interests or their income at all the way the Jews can. The Jews can punish them. For example, E. Michael Jones, who has more courage than the people at Chronicles, but just by way of example, the Jews can call up a place where Dr. Jones is going to speak. Dr. Jones is from Indiana. He's going to speak at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. They call him up and get it canceled. So the Jews can materially affect the income of people like Fleming, and that's why people like Fleming grovel before the Jews, whereas they ignore or blatantly disrespect white nationalists for doing what they ought to be doing, and in many ways know that they ought to be doing, but don't dare to do because they simply don't have the courage. And being intelligent, what intelligent people do when they lack courage is they come up with lengthy rationalizations of their cowardly actions. And that's how so intelligent a man as Dr. Wilson, Dr. Clyde Wilson, can write that we don't have a Negro problem in the U.S. We have a Northerner problem. He simply doesn't have the guts to deal straight on with the obvious problem and the obvious cause of that problem, which is, yeah, we have a Negro problem, and ultimately it traces back to having a Jew-controlled governmental problem. He knows that. He's not going to say it, though. It might be dangerous. He's got his career to look out for. That was always what was particularly despicable about Sam Francis. He wants to be a revolutionary on one hand, but he's also very concerned about his career. And he's smart enough to know that the two don't go together. You either choose one route or you choose the other. You can't be respectable and a revolutionary. You can't say the system needs to be overthrown and then at the same time demand your benefits within the system that employs you. It doesn't work. He wanted to have a foot in the boat and one on the dock. And that's why I did my best to kick the boat out from under him and make the fat man fall in the water. Funny, that metaphor, actually a term I came up with when I'm building our South African news thread, the most relevant story so that you can always get up to speed on what's going on there. And there's a word that they use, and I never knew what it meant, so finally I looked it up. It's like supeed, I think it is. And what it means is salt dick. And it refers to like British South Africans who have one foot in England and one foot in South Africa, and their dick is in the Atlantic. I'm not sure how you pronounce the word, but it's kind of a dismissive word that the Afrikaners, the real South Africans, use for the English descended. Not to imply they're not real South Africans, too. Some of them are. And some of them are just tools. But be that as it may, that's a little digression there. And one other thing we have in the South Africa thread is we have a interesting listing of vocabulary, and then all these different racial groups in South Africa. You've got the Boers, the Bauer, that's a Dutch for Bauer, for German for farmer, peasant. The Boers and the Voortrek, they trekked away from where the British were harassing them. You've got all the different slang that they use. Like blacks have slang for non-South African blacks who've come in there. The Makwerere, I think it is. I don't know how you actually pronounce it, but it's something like that. Makwerere. And then you've got the black slang for whites, and you've got the white slang for blacks, like Kaffir or K4 is another way they, you know, like K9 units for the cop, but they call the niggers like K4s now. Shorthand for Kaffir, I guess. And they have BEE, which I believe is like affirmative action here. It's like black empowered, I thought it might be Bantu educated engineer, but then I thought it might be Black Empowerment Act or something, Black Enabling Act, something like that is what it refers to, blacks who are artificially promoted by race. And those of you who don't get this, you think that In the U.S., when they put in affirmative action, they said it's going to be temporary. You know, you just give blacks a hand up, a leg up, until they can pull equal with other races in the struggle. But what you see is that, in fact, the minute blacks have power, they use it. And they use it to discriminate against whites. And the Jewish press plays along as though all the wealth in South Africa hadn't been created by the whites, but they had stolen it, in fact, from the native blacks, which is utterly ridiculous. 70 IQ people can't create wealth. They can be somewhat herded and managed, you know, to lick envelopes, but they can't really do much more than that. So, I'm getting a little afield here, but my point is that in America, where whites are two-thirds of the population, we have affirmative action, and if you think it'll ever go away, well, the demographic lines show blacks becoming a larger group, Mexicans becoming a larger group. What you see in South Africa, where whites are 1 in 12, as opposed to 8 in 12, is that they have even worse affirmative action. Whites can hardly get any kind of a job beyond janitor over there. It's all given to blacks, and that's why so many blacks, whites have fled the country. Now, okay, we've been going an hour here. It's hard to stop talking about this stuff. It's very interesting. He says, getting back to the post, that said, it must also be pointed out, and I have done so at least 24 times on the site over the past couple of years, that Fleming is simply not an authentic conservative. Race realists, those merely acknowledging the truth about racial differences, and even white racialists, those whose major point of political concern is the biological perpetuity and relative physical and political power of the white European race, do not only obsess over race to the exclusion of all other issues. We simply assert that, one, racial differences are real and have social and political implications, and that, two, the white race is headed toward biological extinction unless we radically reverse the race doesn't matter ostrich attitude of the dwindling white majority. Which I think that's a mischaracterization. It's they're brainwashed to believe there will be consequences if they act on their natural belief that the white race does exist, as shown in their behavior. Withdrawing from the public schools that are teaching anti-white attitudes, moving away from the invading Mexicans, or the blacks expanding from the niggerized cities. Their behavior shows they believe in whiteness. They want to be around white people. They marry white people. To understate the tyranny, to blame the people themselves for the reaction to it. Although ultimately the people must react to it. And that's why we do what we do. We need a revolution. We need to displace and kill the Jews who are running this country. And get rid of them. Violently. And not just violently, but any way possible. They use violence against us regularly. They don't do it themselves. They use blacks. They got rid of the segregation that protected white communities, the free association that allowed whites to segregate themselves from these jungle animals. They did it knowing that there would be 40,000 rapes of white women a year by blacks. Think about that. They knowingly allow these blacks to rape tens of thousands of white women a year. How do we respond to that? What if that's your daughter, your sister, your mother? How do we respond to that? We respond to that by doing whatever we can, by means fair or foul, to destroy and displace these Jews who now run America. They are our enemy. They are evil. They are vicious. They are liars. There is no underhanded tactic they will not use, and they won't use it as a last resort. They'll use it as a first resort often enough. What the anti-white nationalist hysterics on this site, Chronicles, never offer is any solution to our troubles that could be a viable alternative to white nationalism. The endless historical antiquarian hair-splitting of persons like Clyde Wilson is likewise irrelevant. Politics is about power today. And nobody cares about the Old South, the Justice of the Lost Cause, or for that matter, early 20th century regionalist writers, arcane theological disputes over the Latin Mass, the origins of American federalism, and the writings of some obscure Carolina farmer, or so much else of what gets published in Chronicles. So what he's saying is they don't worry about what's actually going on today. That is a complete invasion of the country by Mexicans, courtesy of the Jews running immigration, or the black-on-white crime. All they write about is, you know, John Calhoun. They write about Latin Mass. They write about the Southern agrarians in the 20s and 30s. They write about the Civil War. They're so fixated that they blame Northerners rather than a Negro crime problem caused by Jewish producers. So you get a lot of this sentiment on their own side, and that shows you how dominant white nationalism is. It is the natural stopping point. As people become more aware of what is going on, they move to the right until they end at what is called Nazism or white nationalism or racial realism, however you want to term it, because that's where you logically end up. People don't go the other way. They don't go from being racist to becoming liberals once in a million times, and that's if they have some crazy personal thing. It's never an intellectual journey. The intellectual journey is always from left to right, never from right to left. That's because leftism is fantasyism. It's either people who want power or people who are mentally or morally or intellectually debased, and they live in a dream world and they don't allow reality to interfere with it, and they react violently when someone tries to acquaint them with the fact that their emperor has no clothes. And those people, with their plans for a new world order, are the ones in the league with the Jews, who have their own realistic racial reasons. The Jews are really right-wing. They're not really left-wing. They have Nazi-type views of racial reality. So we know that they aren't against Nazism. They're against Nazism for whites. They're for Nazism for Jews, National Socialism. They want their own to be protected and prospered over everybody else. But they resent it when we try to achieve even equal opportunity for our own, equal protection for our own, equal rights for our own. They're against that. So the Jews are against us because they know we're right. Because we want for our people what they already have secured for their people. They try to deny even the fact that we exist. The Jewish race is a construct. Dead Jews and live Jews must be bashed until there aren't any left. Does it sound weird to say that? Well, that's what a Jewish professor, Noel Ignatieff, said about whites. I'm going to keep on bashing dead white males and live white males until the whole rotten social construct called whiteness is destroyed. You know, not... He said demolished, utterly destroyed and demolished. That's how they feel about the white race. It's the cancer of human history. As Susan Sontag said, white people, the white race, is the cancer of human history. That's what a Jew said. That's the Jewish attitude towards whites. Let's see, what do we got here? We got a few more comments, and then we'll get done, and we'll play a little more music. I have some more tunes that are going to interest you, and then we'll move on. But What you get here in that comment I just read is you get what Chronicle covers, what a conservative magazine covers, versus what the people want to know about and need to know about in order to affect real-world changes. But the Chronicle's people are saying, oh, go hide in your library and read Beowulf. Read a story about a fight instead of actually fighting. He says, okay, actually that's not fair, his critique of the magazine. I'm interested in these issues myself, and I'm grateful they're broached in the magazine, as my own intellectual development would be poor without them. My point is that they do not substitute for a frank and brutal assessment of where things stand now in the real world. And what is clear is that the civilization which Chronicles and its editors purport to defend is the epiphenomenal product of the white man's unique psyche. Could not have been created apart from the genetic endowments of the white race, as Francis expressed it, stating the obvious, and cannot be expected to endure unto the ages if whites should be finally artificially turned into demographic minorities in their own historic homelands. So, culture is blather, but race is real. You get rid of the people who created America, you ain't going to have no constitutional republic made out of niggers and Mexicans presided over by Jews. It just won't work. So the question for Fleming et al. Is simply, can the white race, and by extension the Occident, or the West, be perpetuated if we continue to avoid honest racial discussions? Or, how can the white race be preserved if people like Fleming are permitted to rule discussion of, quote, the preservation of the white race, unquote, as somehow out of bounds? So here you have, on one hand, Fleming is claiming he allows open and unrestricted debate on race, and then on the other hand, you have him mocking white nationalism and saying it's ridiculous. White race doesn't exist. Just like his liberal brethren. And remember, he marched in the civil rights movement to empower Jewish communists over white America, so how hostile is he to the white race? Well, Don't look at the man's words, look at his actions. Well, actually, they back each other right now. He says the white race doesn't exist, and he acted against it. He was an activist against it, joining with the Jewish communists, promoting Martin Luther King over the civilized, segregated South that today he affects to defend. Mocking, after all, the own North that he was part of. It was the Northerners who went down there with the Jews to destroy the South. So, how much credibility does he have? Fleming should attempt to refute those aspects of white racial nationalism he finds unpersuasive instead of trying to expel nationalists from the discussion in the manner of the dilettante William F. Buckley and his many pontifical excommunications. You see, we race realists and nationalists are growing in number and assertiveness precisely in tandem with the continuing decline of white power. We are not going to go away, and indeed we fully intend to become the dominant faction on the true right. I've long expected that transformation to occur between 2020 and 2030, assuming no positive change in immigration policies. Fleming is smart enough to recognize both that we have the energy on the right, as well as that objective political and social situations increasingly favor our side. Yes, whites are about the weakest species in the known universe, but as conditions worsen, the voices of PC will be ever less persuasive, those of the racialist ever more emboldened. He is worried. He should be. That's a pretty good summary of where we are. The old right, as represented by decrepit organs like Chronicles, are giving way to young people who are like, we have nothing to lose. These people are out for our blood. And it's not a matter of theory. We can simply look at South Africa. Go to VNNforum.com, go to our Europe section, look under South Africa. We have a sub-forum under Europe called South Africa, and just read up on what goes on there on a daily basis. Daily, whites are being raped and murdered, and they're 1/12 of the population. It will happen here because biology doesn't change. Culture may change a little from country to country, but blacks here or there are incapable of human civilization. And where they mix with whites, the whites are destroyed. The whites must retake power in their own countries from the Jews that loose the niggers into their communities, with an eye toward destroying them. And that is the bottom line, and the conservatives know it, but they run from it because they're cowards and they have a material interest that can be damaged if they spoke the plain truth. So the old guard must be replaced by the new guard, and the conservatives at Talkie-Mag, National Review, Chronicles must be driven out as appeasers and collaborators with the Jewish liberals who run the country. They maintain the system by giving otherwise intelligent, moneyed, brave, daring people false hope, false alternatives, false places to put their time and effort. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the Chronicles crowd says race doesn't matter as a way of keeping their crumb flow going from the master's table to the dog at the foot of the master, grateful for the occasional bit of off chicken or potato. All right, we've made our way about halfway through the remainder of the comments on this page. He says, shutting down post-1965 immigration policy does not require a deep and sustained debate about which race is the smartest and which race is the dumbest based upon a score and an IQ test. Thought experiment. If white Americans are completely replaced by millions of Chinese currently living in China, America would cease to exist. Millions of native-born white Americans are not interchangeable with millions of Chinese living in China. America is not an idea nation. That's another meme peddled by Jews, that America is a nation of ideas or an experiment or a creedal nation rather than a blood and soil nation. And that's what they insist at the same time they try to undermine our immigration laws to let in all these people from the sewers of the world so that we become a racial grab bag like New York City, which is an environment Jews like to live in. Good for the Jews, bad for us. All the Jews care about is what is good for Jews, and whatever is good for Jews, you can rest assured, is bad for whites. And what's good for whites should be your number one political concern. To the extent you have time to worry about matters beyond your own family, you should be worried about what is good for your race, because your race is your extended family, your extended clan. people who are like and look like and think like you do and want to live like you do. You can live at a higher common denominator with these people than you can with the other races. So you should worry about your race just like you worry about everything else. Don't listen to the Christian liars who claim that race doesn't matter and anyone can just become a Christian and it'll all work out in the wash. It won't. Christianity cannot turn a nigger into a human. Someone else says, yes, very few native-born white Americans would identify themselves as a white nationalist. However, a majority of them vote with their feet against the blessings of diversity. This is why the suburbs of the American South are becoming saturated with Northeasterners and Midwesterners, and why open space, farmland, and forests in the American South are being paved over for white refugees from the immigrant-infested areas of the Northeast. And don't forget the water shortages. One does hear more and more horror stories of racial and economic dispossession from people who previously were willing to completely adapt to a system that hates them. The anger and rage towards non-whites is right under the surface. When 9/11 happened, that anger and rage was briefly uncorked, and it was quite nasty, to the point that the degenerate and evil George W. Bush saved Muslim America's ass by publicly embracing the imams and mullahs on the White House front lawn on 9/12. He says, 95% of Northerners don't even know what Reconstruction is or was. They are functioning in a survival mode, as many of them are only a few paychecks from the street. Which is correct. You know, we got to forget we're in a hothouse environment here, where a few selected brains are doing battle over things that, as this writer says, 95% of the public is totally unaware of. You couldn't tell. I mean, they literally don't know where the next state is. They couldn't put Canada on a map, let alone tell you what Reconstruction was. They would have a hard time telling you what century the Civil War happened in, even World War II. You can never underestimate how dumb the public is. And another guy says, Southerners versus Yankees? In this day and age? What asininities? We are all complicit. If the white race has allowed itself to be pummeled into the mindless acceptance of and submission to the diversity is good, diversity is a blessing mantra by a fraction of the population and its guilt-ridden useful idiots in politics, academia, the media, and even business, isn't that sufficient proof that the race has no claim to supremacy? If we turn into a brown third world cesspool, my congratulations to the barbarians. To the victor goes the spoils. That is an immutable truth. Those who will not fight with every fiber of their beings to keep what they have earned deserve to lose all. That is hard justice. I remember reading an article by someone who stated, in regard to government confiscatory firearm schemes, that if one is not prepared to actually shoot the government agent who may come to seize his lawfully owned weapons, he should not boast about how they must pry his cold dead hands, etc. What I read here is all empty rhetoric. White Americans have allowed their position to be compromised in the name of equality for people who, in great percentages, give not a damn to better themselves, despite being handed every opportunity. We have elected the government that has wrought this condition and said amen with every tax payment. The old saying is true, you really can't rape the willing. Pretty good points. Either you fight back or you tolerate. And whites have not begun to fight back yet. Here we have someone responding to Prosium. He says, I am a Southerner, Presbyterian, Confederate, and pro-white. Despite what you may think, most of us paleos are racially conscious. Only a fool would not be. I really enjoy your comments here and look forward to reading them. Prosium says, Burke, yes, I know. There is a lot of overlap between the paleo and racialist communities. We share many of the same concerns. I have been reading Pat Buchanan for 7 years now. I have copies of all his books. It was his book, Death of the West, which first alerted me to the seriousness of the threat that changing racial demographics posed to our civilization. It seems so long ago. I was a sophomore at Auburn at the time. I have also been following Clyde Wilson's career since those days. I share his interest in Southern history and political theory. I'm one of the few people who owns a copy of The Essential Calhoun. I do, too. I own biographies of Robert Barnwell Rhett and William Lowndes Yancey, two political figures that 99.5% of Americans should be unable to identify. I'm not old enough to remember the old right, so I don't romanticize it as some of you do here. In my case, conservatism never took. The conservatism on offer when I came of age was Bush, Cheney, Hannity, Limbaugh, Coulter, etc. The conservative movement must be in a state of advanced decay when it churns out titles like, If the Democrats Had Any Brains, They'd Be Republicans, Liberal Fascism, Deliver Us From Evil, while ostracizing Sam Francis and Jared Taylor. Looking forward, I see unprecedented challenges facing my generation, and I don't see conservatives offering any answers to them. Conservatives are part of the problem because, one, they give legitimacy to the racial cultural status quo. That's a VNN point. And two, how they siphon off all the discontent within the system and redirect that energy into destructive channels like pushing Wall Street's economic agenda. Also a good point. Lots of paleos and libertarians are coming to share our way of thinking. We're not on the same side as George W. Bush, Juan McCain, Bill Kristol, and the neocons around them. It's a sad day in America when the bedrock foundation of our culture, the white race and the English language, have become political questions. But that's where we are. Our dire circumstances demand fresh thinking. It doesn't take too many mouse clicks to figure out who is responsible for bringing us to this point or what it will take to salvage the remains of this country. That's what it's going to come to in the end. And what he means there is exactly that. You click around, you find VNN, and you learn that the Jews are at the root of this and that Christianity is not going to save you. The church is long ago subverted. When they changed their own opinion of the Jews who killed Jesus, they showed they have no respect for their own main figure. They don't believe their own bullshit. The Jews, when they murdered Jesus, said, "His blood be on us and upon our children." And the Catholics have now rejected that and said, "Well, no, it's not the Jews who are to blame," even though the Jews themselves demanded almost, bragged almost, that they deserve to be blamed. When they generalize the blame from the Jews to everybody, they just show that they're cowards and they don't believe their own bullshit. And that makes them weak. And things that are weak like that deserve to be kicked. Because they're weak. They deserve to be despised. But what's strong is white nationalism. We believe our own bullshit. Because we know it's not bullshit, it's the truth. The races are different, and we should be on top, not the Jews. The Jews should not be allowed to use niggers and Mexicans to destroy white communities. That simple. Now, just a couple more and we'll be done here and we'll go to a little more music. Here's an interesting point someone makes. What can one say about an historian and classical scholar who romanticizes the Confederacy while hating race realists who simply want to protect whites from black and Hispanic violence and revanchism and end massive third world immigration? Now one can't even tell the truth about black intelligence, black criminality, black and white violence, etc. at Chronicles, Talkie Mag, and Lou Rockwell without being vilified or censored. So he's saying, and any of these paleo-libertarian or conservative or libertarian or paleo-libertarian sites, Chronicles, Talkie Mag, and Lou Rockwell, you can't even tell the truth about race without being censored. Just another liberal rag. As the late William F. Buckley's mentor, William Moore Kendall, said about National Review 30, 40 years ago. Same thing with these so-called conservative magazines, these paleocon magazines, these libertarian ones. They won't let you tell the truth about race and Jews because it threatens their material interests. So here they are pretending to be very high-minded and, oh, we're classical scholars, oh, blah, blah, blah. We're the ones who care about culture and preserving it in the Western traditions. But blunt biological facts need not apply at Chronicles or at LouRockwell.com or at Talkie Mag. They scare the Christians and the women, if there's any difference between those. Better keep them down, better keep them away. And we know, we've talked earlier about Lou Rockwell censoring people. He kicked off Carol Ward, not because he disagreed with her, but because he agreed with her. Remember Joe Sobran's point. It's much more threatening when you agree with someone, but you don't want them saying what they are, than when you disagree. When you disagree, well, then you can make it public and say, "I disagree with you." But if you agree with them, but you don't dare have them say it, that's when the real problems start. And Rockwell agrees with the racialist stuff. He wrote the racialist stuff that was attributed to Ron Paul because it appeared in his own newsletter. And both this Southern heroic Lou Rockwell and Ron Paul ran like scared little bunnies when a 23-year-old Jewish faggot approached them with quotes from their own publication. That's how ridiculous these grown men are. Lou Rockwell's fired at least three people for writing honestly about race. Carol Ward, Bob Wallace, and Jimmy Cantrell. Three of the best writers he ever had. Who does he replace them with? Ah, he replaces them with more borderline talented Jewish hacks. And Rockwell didn't replace them because they were wrong. He replaced them because they were making sharper points than he wanted at LouRockwell.com, thereby threatening his income. Pitiful. And again, to conclude this discussion, two more comments. First, one from Svigor, quoting Tom Fleming, who's the main guy at Chronicles. As I told one young friend of mine, whining about anti-white, anti-male job discrimination, white guys don't whine. You know, says the guy who's got his and who has no danger of being discriminated against. If you complain about discrimination, you're a whiner. And this is from a guy who knows what the situation is in his own field in academia, who knows that unless you're a Marxist, you know, if you're not a Marxist, then you have essentially struck out in the system because it's already loaded in favor of women, coloreds, Jews, etc., 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 and homos. And if you don't fit into one of those protected classes and you're a white male, then you'd better toe the ideological line. And if you don't toe that, well, what have you got going for you? Nothing. They won't hire you. Or you'll get, you know, temporary minor assignments at third-rate cow colleges, and you won't be able to get on the tenure track toward a full professoriate. He knows this. He says they're whiners. Are the white guys in South Africa whiners when, you know, virtually every position has affirmative action requirements attached to it, and they can't find work? And what the hell? This, the guy responding to this, quoting it and responding, says, no, they sit there and suck it up, right? There's a recipe for success. I wonder how many suckers will fall for your Pied Piper act. Finally, the last comment on here, well, 145, there's one more. And then I think they locked it because I'm sure there would have been more comments, is from Prosium, 145. Should America, he says, two questions. Should America be a white man's country? Two, should America be an English-speaking nation? These are fundamental questions about our national identity. It's sad that these are now political questions, but that's where we are. Note, the conservative answer to both of the above is no. America is not a white man's country. It should not be. And it should not be an English-speaking nation. The conservatives don't stand for anything real. They claim to want to preserve things, but they deny the basis of those things. The culture comes from the race. You don't get the glorious things of Western civilization without your starting point being the white genetic material. Even the Chronicles' own Sam Francis acknowledged that. But the current leaders of Chronicles are afraid to say that. And that's why they go out of their way to denounce with spitting hostility any white who brings it up. The beauty of the internet is we don't need these old guys, these tired old sacks who have nothing to do but read Beowulf. Which, I don't know if you've read Beowulf. It's nothing that great. That's for damn sure. Probably a lot of you out there like Miss and that kind of thing. You might like it, but I don't know. I didn't think it was that good. Good book. I wouldn't go see the movie. But let's conclude our discussion there for now. Spend about an hour and a half on that. Let me play. I'll probably play four songs in this set, and let's see. What would be good? I'm going to play... All right, I'm gonna play. I think you'll like these. We'll play four songs, and we will wrap it up with a little Italian number. The fifth song will be a little Italian number. Yeah, we'll play five songs, and then we'll come back and we'll discuss. Non-native invasive species. So what you're going to hear a couple songs you've heard me play before, and then you're going to hear three songs you've never heard me play before, and we'll see what you think of them. So here we go, starting with Cat Stevens.
I keep on wondering if I sleep too long. pick up the same old soap. And keep on wondering if I sleep too long. Will I even wake up again? No, I am. The times there were when I thought not. Lean, didn't have my soul in bad company. I thank the moon I had the strength to stop. Oh, I'm not making love to anyone's wishes, only for that light I see. 'Cause when I'm dead and Lord, Lord, in my grave, that's gonna be the only thing that's left of me. If I make it to the water side, will I even find me a boat or so? And if I make it to the water side, I'll be sure to write you a note or something. Yo, I'm on my way, I know I am. Somewhere not so far from here. All I know is all I feel right now. I feel the power going in my hair. Oh, life is like a maze of doors, and they all open from the side you're on. Just keep on pushing hard, boy. Try as you may, you're gonna wind up where you started from. You're gonna wind up where you started from.
Thank you. Yeah. Catarina, Catarina, perché mi dici sto parole amare? Perché me parli o cuore mi dormiente, Catarina, non te scordare. Che t'ha aiutato cuore, Catarì, non te scordà. Catarì, Catarì, che ben a dicere, so parlò con me da spaseme, tu non ci pensas stu dolore mio, tu non ci pensi, tu non tieno cor, core, cor ingrato, dai pigliato a vita mia, tutto è passato, non ci pensi più, cuore, cuore ingrato, dai figlio tua vita mia.
Wasn't that nice? That was Cuore Ingrato by Dominique Chianese. Probably pronouncing that wrong, but at least they got the spirit of it. We started off with some Cat Stevens, and we moved into Where You Get Love by Matthew Sweet. From there we went on to Dear Prudence by Susie and the Banshees. Whether you know it or not, that is actually a cover of a tune by one of the Beatles, John Lennon. I think he wrote it to some girl who was staying indoors on a nice day over in India. After that, we had Save a Prayer by Duran Duran, who I think wears surprisingly well compared to some of the so-called classic rock. All right, and now let's get to our second segment, and here we're going to deal with invading species, non-human division. And let me see here. Okay, let's see there. What we got here is a story from late February, and headline of the story is Texas tries to control invasion of exotic snakes. Non-native species can do lots of damage to environment. I'm going to read some of this, and I want you to take note of the highly prejudicial language for the limbless community, as you may have noticed. Being incapable of suppressing a typewriter key or wielding a pen in their coils are singularly unproductive of letters to the editor, nor do they, in any great numbers, file lawsuits or place agitated calls to advertisers. Therefore, they may be reviled with impunity the unfooted members of our community, as I say. Now, let's read a little bit and just take note of some of the language. Texas, like the rest of the nation, continues losing ground in its war against Mexicans. I'm sorry, it doesn't actually say that. It says, continues losing ground in its war against non-native invasive species, like Mexicans. If you guess that I added that like Mexicans part, you're right. This month, giant salvinia, one of the most destructive and persistent of alien aquatic plants. Alien aquatic, that sounds a little biased. Maybe it's just an undocumented aquatic plant. Was documented for the first time in three more Texas lakes, Rayburn, Palestine, and Brady Branch. Discovered in Texas in a single small pond in Houston only a decade ago, salvinia has spread to dozens of public and private waters across the eastern third of the state. That would be the more verdant region of the state. Farther west you go in Texas, the more plains-like and deserty, arid, and waterless it becomes. Well, pretty much once you get too far west of Dallas, you start getting into West Texas and you start getting a pretty barren area. I don't know if you've ever been to where Texas Tech is out there. And my God, the town, I want to say Waco, but it's not Waco. Waco's south. You start getting really serious windy plains, pretty barren, bleak, desolate places out there. Anyway, but I digress. Now I undigress. Just funny to read. Now, there's lots more to the story, but so just a decade ago, giant salvinia was in one pond, and now it's over a third of the state, and it's kind of like the Mexican invasion, where earlier this year, I think it was, or I'm sorry, it was probably last year, whites became a non-majority in Texas. They're the largest minority, but they're not a numerical majority in Texas. And I remember going to a law school graduation, and the main speaker was the female head of the state Supreme Court. And she bragged. I may have mentioned this on one of the Goyfars at one point. She bragged about departing from written precedent. Mind you, this is in a speech to a graduating class of lawyers. She bragged about departing from written precedent and following her heart and coming up with a ruling that equalized funding across districts, meaning that local control was removed. This is always a big deal for progressives and leftists and communists and Jews. They always want to take children away from their parents and take parents' money away. Take parents' money away from the local district and turn it over to the state, because that way they have more control over it. And their idea is the parents controlling their own money and controlling their own children and controlling what goes in the mind of their children is dangerous, because the parents are the source of racism and other evil backwards beliefs that the state schools and the state government are required to expunge, so far from being a representative of the people and fulfilling their interests, looking after their interests and their needs. They're supposed to expunge them and get the people in line with the state program. So just imagine how this article would be written if it were written about Mexicans. Could be used the same thing, you know, Texas a decade ago, you know, or before the civil right, before the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, you know, Texas was what? I don't know what it was. It was probably 80-90% white, and now what is it? It's less than 50% white. The latest state for whites go under being the numerical majority because of this invasive species, as she describes the plant, because of this destructive and persistent alien called the Mexican, giant salvinia. What about Jesus and Maria? They're a little more dangerous than giant salvinia. But they go on about this horrible plant, able to grow so quickly and densely that it smothers the life from the water it covers and seemingly impossible to eradicate. Giant Salvinia and Mexicans are just one of the most recent invaders to inflict severe damage on Texas's ecosystems and the plants and animals that depend on them, upon them. The list of non-native species that have found their way into Texas thrived and wreaked havoc. Well, she says wreaked havoc because she doesn't know any better, being a journalist and all. Familiarity with English being foreign to her. The list of non-native species that have found their way into Texas thrived and wreaked havoc on our natural resources and wallets is soberingly long. Imagine if you wrote about Mexicans like that. The list of havoc wreaked by Mexicans is soberingly long. They bankrupted X, Y, and Z hospital. They've introduced all kinds of drugs and diseases. They've soaked up all kinds of welfare money. They've despoiled numerous towns and sections of towns. I mean, on and on and on. She lists these other problem species. Fire ants, feral hogs, Chinese tallow, McCartney rose, water hyacinth, salt cedar, hydrilla, grass carp, nutria, Mexicans. No, again, that was me including the Mexicans, not her. Formosan termites. Those are some of the big ones. So all these are non-native invasive species. And this is interesting to me to read because I get Missouri conservationists and they make the same kind of complaints about Missouri. I know in particular Missouri has feral hogs that you're more or less encouraged to shoot on sight and ask questions later. They don't have any season or anything. Just shoot them if you see them because they rip up agriculture. How much environmental and economic damage do alien invasive species do in this country? About $120 billion a year, according to a 2004 study by the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at Cornell University. That's three times as much as ExxonMobil's $40 billion in profits this year. It's seven times more than Microsoft's annual profits. It's a lot of money. So, non-native invasive species, not counting the humanoid or the human-shaped invasive species, called third worlders, or Mexicans in particular, do $120 billion a year in damages. Well, how much do the Mexicans do in damages when they soak up our social services and they send our money home to Mexico and they bankrupt our hospitals and they put incredible strain on the public schools? Well, you'd never see an honest article written about that, would you? In fact, it would talk about how hardworking those fire ants are. Boy, those suckers get up early in the morning and they just race out and they build another colony. They're a real family people, those fire ants. They really stick together. I know some people don't like them, but they're just bigots. In Texas, fire ants' annual damage to wildlife, livestock, and public health is estimated at $300 million. Feral hogs do $52 million worth of damage a year. Isn't that interesting? Fire ants do $300 million worth of damage. How much do Mexicans do to Texas each year? I'm going to guess they do about $30 billion worth of damage. But the most sobering destruction caused by invasive species is the damage done to the wildlife, fisheries, and the ecosystems they invade. See, they make it impossible for local native species to exist. So, unlike among humans, where the people who run the media pretend there are no interests that can't be reconciled, we all have the same interests, we're all humans, kumbaya, when it comes to lower animals, they freely admit that some drive out others and that the interests of these different species are opposed and irreconcilable. Fire ants are directly responsible for the staggering decline in Texas's horned lizard numbers, the near vanishing of some native ant species, and certainly a factor in the decline of some other wildlife. Well, you know, I don't understand that, because if humans can get along, if diversity and multiculturalism work for humans, why don't they work for fire ants and other native ant species in Texas? Why can't the fire ants and the other ants get along? Maybe they just need some good Christian preaching. Or maybe the state legislature of Texas just needs to pass a law enforcing that fire ants respect the native culture. Do you see how what we take for granted among animals, we laugh at among humans, even as exactly the same processes occur and exactly the same results are carried out? The bad drives out the good, the more powerful drives out the weaker, even if the weaker is more refined and better. In some ways, if it's weaker or if it leaves the door open in others, it gets driven out. It's ridiculous to talk about harmony. Nature knows no harmony. Nature knows struggle for position. You can even see this among plants if you do time-lapse photography of them. You can see them basically fighting each other for physical space and for access to sunlight and to water, fighting. It's just an extreme slow motion. And so it is with human demographic change. The races, just like ants and just like every lower form of animal, fight and struggle for room, for sunlight, for growth, and all the things humans need to thrive. And one of the ways they do battle is through controlling the thoughts and ideas that go into the mind of their competitors. That's why the Jews control the media, so they can fill the heads of their competitors with things that aren't true, but things which help the Jews to thrive. They put in their papers only that which is good for Jews. The facts about lower animals don't threaten the Jews, but the facts about human animals do threaten the Jews. So they won't ever appear in a newspaper that you can buy on the street. The facts will only appear in news that you can get that is produced and edited and delivered by people between whom and you there is no filter, such as me and you. There is no Jew between me and you, as our own James Hawthorne says. And I am the only voice you will hear today of which that is not true. Everybody else you will hear when you get in your car and turn on the radio will have been filtered by the Jews to ensure political reliability, just as in the old Soviet Union. No one will appear on Christian evangelical radio who is not on the side of Israel and the Jewish agenda. He may depart from it in tiny, small, insignificant ways, but on nothing major will he depart. Say race. He will never say that race matters. You'll never hear that from a controlled media station. Anyone with advertisers and FCC license will lie to you, and must as a condition of keeping their job. Invasive plants such as phragmites and salvinia and Chinese tallow take over landscapes and waters, shoving out native plants, corrupting whole ecosystems, and dooming many species of native plants and animals. Well, that's interesting, because I've sat in parks in Texas, and I've seen third worlders displacing what would formerly have been white people, just as the Chinese tallow is displacing other native weeds in the local ponds and rivers. In Texas, salt cedars suck so much water that often adjacent springs and creeks stop flowing, or the waterway's salinity increases so much it is uninhabitable by native species. You know what? That just sounds like a different culture, and I think it needs to be respected. Choking off waterways is what salt cedar does. Maybe there needs to be a little sensitivity training for people who think that waterways ought to be open. That's awfully bigoted. What about these people who don't like Chinese tallow? Who are they to say that Chinese tallow is any worse than any other plant? It has its own way of living, man. Get used to it. Don't be so uptight. Have you ever heard of multiculturalism and diversity? Had we world enough in time? We don't have world enough in time. It's a struggle. Life is struggle. The negative impact of non-native species on native plants, animals, and fish is as pervasive as it is hard to exaggerate. Competition, predation, or other impacts of invasive species are considered the primary risk factors facing about 400 of the approximately 1,000 species listed as threatened or endangered under this country's Endangered Species Act, according to a 1998 study. So 40% of all the species that are on the endangered, that are covered by the Endangered Species Act, are basically under attack by foreigners. Does that sound like the U.S. to you? We now have a 300 million population, and you know, a few decades ago we only had 150 million people here. 90% of the immigration since 1965 is non-white, and virtually all of the illegal immigration is non-white. And the illegal immigration, well, which is a contradiction, you can't, immigration is by definition legal. Invasion is allowed. It's winked at by the government. The government is in control of one of the invading parasitic species that is hostile to the native species. The whites were in America's first. Then they were wiped out by reds. Then they returned from Europe and conquered the reds. Whites are like that. And now another reconquering is needed. And that's what we're about bringing about. But control of our government was taken by one of the invading species, the Jew, coming over from Poland and Russia. And the Jew has done what it could to prevent our recognition of the problem, so that you will never see an article appearing in a paper that writes up the Endangered Species Act ought to include white people, because they're under attack by invading species from Mexico and from Africa and from China. And the campaigns of these invaders are conducted by the Jews who let them in, who argued for decades to reverse our immigration policy until they finally got it through the Hart-Celler bill. Faced with the onslaught of invasive species and spending billions fighting them, state and federal governments have begun trying to address the root causes of the problem: humans transporting and introducing non-native species. So see, that's like when I say, let's get to the root problem of immigration. What is it? Is it the federal government doesn't have the will to do something about it? Or that they can't do something about it? That immigration is like with the weather, it's just something you have to deal with because you can't control it? No. The federal government could shut down the border if it wanted. It's not difficult. But it chooses not to. It's a political decision. But see, when it comes to animals, why, they go right to the root of the problem. They don't deal with the symptoms and act like there's nothing we can do. Even though in that case it's much closer to the truth that there's nothing you can do. Even though the people who are bringing in these foreign pests are often themselves invading species. And what they're bringing are stuff from their native land over in Asia or from down in South America or Mexico. They say now. It's now. Texas has imposed a prohibition on possessing dozens of non-native species of plants, fish, animals, a list that grows longer each year. And do you think some woman coming in from Korea or coming in from Vietnam is going to give a flying fig what Texas imposes prohibitions on? If she wants to eat salted duck eggs or something from Korea, they don't give a damn about that. They've often busted these gooks, these Asians out there stealing our native wildlife, while they also bring in their own and let it go. It's now a misdemeanor criminal violation in Texas for people to not remove from their boat trailers any non-native vegetation such as hydrilla, hyacinth, and salvinia. Well, that's too little too late. It's not going to do much if it's already spread over a third of the state. It's going to keep on spreading over pretty much all the waters of the state. It's the same thing with mussels in Missouri and a lot of other states. They're trying to, these non-native mussels come in and just crowd out the native ones, zebra mussels in particular. And beginning on April 1st, any person in Texas possessing or offering for sale any venomous snake not native to Texas or any of the five species of non-native constrictors will have to obtain a permit from the state. Acting on a mandate from the 2007 session of the legislature, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission this past month adopted rules creating a controlled exotic snake permit. So, under terms of the regulations, any person possessing or transporting a venomous snake not native to Texas, a green anaconda, or any of the four species of python, African rock, Asiatic rock, reticulated, Southern African, must buy an annual permit from the TPWD. Private owners of the regulated species will be required to annually purchase a $20 recreational controlled exotic snake permit. Businesses selling snake species covered under the regulations would be required to hold a $60 annual commercial exotic snake permit. It's funny, I remember I go down to South Padre in Texas sometimes, and there used to be a guy selling, he was selling all kinds of little snakes and lizards and turtles and other things out of like a school bus that was kind of converted into a little pet shop. And I remember I talked to him one time, and it was I'd come back after a few years in between, and he was only selling like turtles, and he just said it was getting worse and worse in Texas. It was like he said in Florida, the wildlife department was basically a bunch of fascists who were running the state, and they wouldn't let you do jack shit without busting you, and they basically could come in at any time of day or night without needing a permit, whatever. Now, probably exaggeration, but basically they have a lot of power to bust people. And Texas is, in many ways, has been a pretty free state, but it's kind of getting the same way as what he was saying, and it just wasn't economically feasible to do anything but sell turtles at that point. More people, you get more regulation. It's that simple. Especially when there are people who don't follow the law, like third worlders don't. Let's see. Texas hopes to avoid, or at least defer, seeing the problems Florida currently faces with exploding feral populations of large non-native snakes. Exploding feral populations of hogs, snakes, and Mexicans. Think about it. Over the past decade, released or escaped pythons have established breeding populations in southern Florida. So there are now pythons in the wild in Florida, South Florida. Just in Everglades National Park, more than 400 Burmese Asiatic pythons, some 13 to 15 feet long, have been found and removed. Wow. Florida makes owners of the large non-native snakes pay a hefty price for the potentially damaging reptiles, and has imposed a method of trying to track and punish owners of escaped or released big snakes. As in Texas, anyone in Florida convicted of releasing one of the non-native snakes faces a heavy fine. Sadly, the natural world is paying a much higher price from such irresponsible acts. Pretty interesting. I think that report was in the Houston Chronicle. TheChron.com. So, you can write about animals, and you can write about animals as belonging to different and competing species, and you can write about one species driving out another. You can write about species having different needs, needs that are not compatible. You can write about it as though it's an either-or situation. Either you have the kind of conditions that favor niggers, or you have the kind of conditions that favor humans. But you can never, ever write about humans that way. But don't be fooled for a minute and think that the exact same rules that apply to every other animal don't apply to humans, because they do. They do. And that, my friends, is what white flight really means. Conditions are not suitable for whites to reproduce and to live happily, so they exit those conditions and seek better conditions. And that's why 85% of the time whites move to a whiter area. And then you'll have people say that, you know, whites are suicidal, or whites don't care, or they're not. Well, their behavior shows they do care. What they're missing is leadership. Leadership that is willing to stand up to the species that are destroying us, partly by pretending there's not a problem, and partly by pretending we don't even exist as a group, while at the same time slamming us as a group. If we exist as a group to be rebuked and mocked and criticized and smeared on TV, and we exist as a group to be discriminated against by the government, state and federal, then we damn sure exist as a group that needs to come together and protect its interests. That's just self-evident. So obvious that even a paleoconservative PhD can see it. Now, let's move on to another little story I found that relates to this, and talk about humans in the context of biological evolution. And as one subspecies or species gains a an advantage over the other has to evolve something to compete with it. And that's what we're doing here. We're giving you the truth, and we're explaining to you, and we are developing media that are an evolution in response to what the Jews have done to give whites, for the first time in a long time, the upper hand over the Jews. Well, so it is in other places in nature, and I found this in a search for snakes. And what you see here is a story called, from Science Daily, Snakes Vault Past Toxic Newts in Evolutionary Arms Race. So basically, the newt has a poison, but the garter snake has developed a way to counter that poison so it can keep on eating newts. Pretty fascinating stuff. And you see the parallel to white media. That is No Jews Just Right, the slogan of our founding site, VanguardNewsNetwork.com. No Jews Just Right. By excluding Jews and identifying them as the enemy and pointing out their MO and their tactics and explaining how they come after us, we help whites evolve defenses against these evil, hostile, parasitic predators of our kind. And therefore, we evolve to be more fit in this world we live in and make things better for ourselves, just as the German nationalists did. They figured out what the Jews were up to and they beat them at it. They kicked them out of Germany. They got them to all emigrate. They didn't actually gas them like the Jews claim. What they did was force them to emigrate. I was reading, right now, one of the books I'm reading is I Will Bear Witness, 1933 to 45. It's a diary by a Jew named Victor Klemperer, and he's a professor in Germany, and he stays in Germany through the duration of the war and lives for decades afterwards and wrote a number of books. But think about that. People claim that the Jews are rounded up, stuck in concentration camps and gassed, but here's the guy writing in 1940 in the middle of a very, very hot war. You know, he's exchanging letters with other Jews who are abroad in Switzerland, in Sweden, in the U.S., and what you see is that the Jews are simply lying, that all these Jews emigrated from Germany as Hitler passed successively or progressively stricter laws against them. Like they had to be indoors by 9, and they could only shop from certain hours, and they weren't allowed to use public libraries, and various and sundry other laws discriminated against the Jews that I was. Tetrodotoxin, TTX, by preying on rough-skinned newts, which also secrete the toxin. Some newts are so poisonous that they harbor enough TTX to kill a room full of adult humans. So, why would a small animal produce such an excessive amount of poison? The answer lies in the evolutionary back and forth between newts and garter snakes. Throughout much of their shared territory, newts and snakes have been locked in a kind of arms race. TTX-resistant snakes, tetrodotoxin-resistant snakes, cause natural selection to favor ever more poisonous newts, and the new and improved newts drive selection for higher resistance in snakes. Just as the Jews are driving for higher levels of Jew resistance, Jew knowledge, and Jew awareness in whites, as exemplified by me speaking these truths and by you listening to them. The kind of people who are more resistant to authority, less susceptible to the lies propagated through television, are going to be the whites who survive the genetic bottleneck being imposed on us by our biological competitor, the Jew, who controls the airwaves. And those who see through are the ones who are going to survive. The ones who understand what the Jew is trying to do to us and who actively resist. Those are the ones who are going to be the fathers and mothers of the whites who survive to produce future generations. The other whites, the weaker ones, the ones who don't see the threat, who don't perceive the threat, are going to interbreed with the genetically inferior Mexicans and blacks and produce races of messed up mulattoes, which is, after all, what the Mexicans are. They're mulattoes produced by Mexicans and Spaniards. They're lower IQ, dumber, more aggressive, less desirable people. They're essentially human weeds. USA was a very nice garden built by white people. The Jews took down the barrier and allowed the weed people to come through. If you've ever seen a garden covered up by weeds, that's a pretty good metaphor for what we have in the U.S. today. The shit people, the weed people have come through and rooted. So it is with newts and garter snakes. Newts secrete poison, but because they're nice and yummy, the garter snakes have evolved resistance to the poison so that they can continue to consume these delicious newts. If you've never had fricasseed newt, my friend, you have missed a gustatory pleasure known to a select few. In a new study, Charles Hannafin, a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford's Hopkins Marine Station, and his co-authors say that snakes in some areas may have prevailed in the evolutionary arms race between predator and prey. Surprisingly, snakes in several geographic locations have developed such extreme resistance to TTX, tetrodotoxin, that newt production of the toxin cannot keep up. The snakes have dominated the newts. And the picture along with this story shows a snake eating a newt. These newts are so toxic. They're only 2 or 3 percentage points below Gingrichian levels. He being the racial liberal masquerading as a conservative. There probably isn't a snake on Earth that could actually swallow Newt Gingrich, though. Not even the one we have in our thread that's eating a kangaroo. It's dragging him up out of a billabong, mate. Now, let's see here. The poisonous newts have even killed off humans. The Journal of the AMA reports a case of a 29-year-old man who died after swallowing an 8-inch-long newt on a dare. Now, that's real fucking intelligent. The journal also describes the case of a 26-year-old man in Oregon who managed to survive his encounter with the newts. After swallowing 5 of the animals to win a bet, you talk about fucking evolution. Apparently there are still left walking around these newt-gulping morons. So this 26-year-old man in Oregon swallowed 5 of the newts to win a bet. He felt dizzy, began vomiting, and was too weak to walk, though he later recovered under a doctor's care. God almighty. These moronic incidents aside, the newts rarely harm humans, because most people don't try to eat them. It is not safe to handle the newts with bare hands, since the toxin is not absorbed through the skin, or it is safe to handle them, since the toxin doesn't go through the skin. The newt must be ingested to be toxic. And Hannafin said the animal emits an acrid smell that probably discourages most pets and non-moronic non-children from tasting it.
Dude, try the newt. You'll love it. $5 says you don't dare swallow that newt, man.
First glance, the newt and garter snake populations seem to be evenly matched. The most toxic newts are found in the same areas as highly resistant snakes. Areas without toxic newts house only non-resistant snakes. So again, here we have white people who are out collecting data on this stuff. And since there's no particular money to be made in this area, you don't find a lot of Jewy names like you would in other areas of endeavor that are more politicized. To get a closer look at the snake-newt interaction, Hannafin and colleagues tested 383 newts from 28 locations where the Brodies had previously examined garter snake TTX resistance. Collection spots stretched down the west coast from British Columbia to Central California. Hannafin found the snakes were pulling ahead of the newts in several places. In 1/3 of the locations, the most toxic newt could still be eaten by the least resistant snake. Interesting. This means that all the snakes in the population do just as well, regardless of their TTX resistance level, and there is no evolutionary pressure for the snakes to develop stronger resistance. Just as there is evolutionary pressure on whites to develop excessive awareness of the other and develop more in-group loyalty and more ex-group chauvinism or fear or identification or whatever you want to call it. Otherwise, the whites will be like those encouraged by Fleming to not whine and just accept being discriminated against as the natural order of things, and so pass from the earth with your uncomplaining, unwhining genes. The whites who are more rebellious and more perceptive are the ones who are going to survive, because they'll see that the agenda manifestly pursued by all established authority is highly toxic to them and their kind and their people and their children and their history. And they will resist in every possible form. And they will resist by improving themselves financially and physically and mentally and intellectually in order the better to resist these pressures rather than yield to them. Huh. Interesting. Newts are also limited by their own biology. They are only resistant to their own TTX poison, not immune to it. A few milligrams of TTX injected into a newt's gut are lethal. So its own goddamn poison sacs will kill it if they're in the wrong part of its body. The poison gets out of its sac. While the most toxic newts had 14 to 15 milligrams of TTX, some garter snakes are resistant to up to 100 milligrams of TTX. To hold that much toxin, the tiny newts would have to be one part toxin to nine parts skin, a near physical impossibility, according to Hannafin. And this is how interesting biology is. And remember, facts like these that I'm reading you that are just inherently interesting, they're all discovered by whites. No other race finds this kind of stuff out. Maybe a few Asians do here and there. Maybe even an occasional Jew discovers something that's not a hoax, or later revealed to be fraudulent or stolen from someone else, plagiarized like Einstein, the plagiarist, did E equals MC squared. But whites find all this stuff out. Though snakes may have won this round, Hannafin said, their good fortune may not last forever. There is some evidence that TTX resistance, tetrodotoxin, toxin, comes at a price. Really resistant snakes have slower crawl speeds than snakes with little or no resistance. If there is no advantage to a snake for being super resistant, and super resistance has an evolutionary cost, the snakes could eventually end up with a lowered resistance to the point where the newt's toxin level would again be effective. Though Hannafin said the idea was plausible, it would take years of experiments to confirm. What do you do all day? Well, I'm a newt tester. I test newts. Very gingerly, I might add. And this is funny, and this is how you talk about culture, and this is why you want to build a pattern of some kind into your family, a legacy of knowledge, and maybe a culture built around a specific type of work, because you give your offspring a huge advantage if you can homeschool them and train them up in the ways that maybe took you a long time to discover on your own. Together with his father, a research dermatologist, isn't that interesting? Hannafin devised a method of measuring the newt's toxin levels using the same kind of surgical punch used to take skin for biopsies. Here we have the flowering of white genius, man. Our people are out there figuring out new ways to measure newt toxin levels. Being creative and imaginative and intelligent, they look outside their own field, something just slightly different, and they borrow techniques from it. These are the kind of people who are being killed off by these non-native invading species and these niggers that the Jews have sicked on us, so that there will be fewer of these types of discoveries. You may remember the case of Eric Bish, written up by Will Williams for one of our newspapers. Eric Bish developed a couple varieties of strawberries that were better in the way strawberries can be better, and one day he was in the post office and a 60 IQ nigger came in and killed him. You know, for $20 or something. And he was caught, you know, because he was stupid. He was caught, you know, 10 miles up the road. But this scientist who, like Hannafin, discovered all these interesting and to humans very useful things, was dead. All the years invested in his education, his PhD and his learning, all that stuff is gone the minute someone dies. All wasted. Just like we saw with Eve Carson the other day in North Carolina. Some useless nigger just comes up and robs her and shoots her dead. And she's gone. All that material is wasted. No way to get it back. This is the price we pay for allowing the Jews to control our society and fill us with these diversity lies. And never acknowledge the cost of their position because they aren't honest men. They can't survive honest debate. All they can do is lie and suppress the truth. They have no other option. The facts are not on their side. And let's give some credit here. He says Hannafin, not only did he learn from his father, he actually learned from Japanese. And the Japanese are quite an advanced race, as some Asians are, the northern Asians. So Hannafin went over there and learned techniques from the blowfish researchers. And if we didn't have the Jews, we could live happily as a white nation. The Jews and the Asians could live happily as Asians, and there wouldn't be any problem. But Hannafin spent 2 months in Japan learning techniques from blowfish researchers. After the procedures were ironed out, Hannafin and his colleagues spent 5 years collecting enough newts to test. Hannafin said the newts make convenient field animals. They're pretty mellow. They don't really get worked up about being handled, he said. If you're collecting them in a pond, they just kind of float around you. The newts' toxicity means they can afford to be lax about evading rubber-booted researchers, and Hannafin caught most of the animals by hand. He said he did not envy the snake collectors who chased the rapid slithering animals through grass and underbrush. Future directions of Hannafin's research include learning more about human disease by exploring the genetics of resistant garter snakes. TTX blocks electrical signaling in nerve cells by stopping up a sodium channel, and TTX-resistant tetrodotoxin-resistant snakes have a modified channel that the toxin does not recognize. In humans, defects in similar sodium channels can lead to serious illness, including some types of epilepsy, and insight into sodium channel biology can help treat these diseases. Pretty interesting stuff. So that's the kind of good work whites are out there doing. And it's also an example of evolution as two different species struggle to survive. And that's what our show's about, struggling to survive. All right, let's leave it there, and play a couple more songs, and when we come back, we'll talk a little about Nazis and homosexuals. And we won't get all the way through it. I'm starting to flag a little bit. I haven't been up about 16 hours or so, but we will get part of the way into it, and it's very fascinating stuff. Because understanding the Nazis is vitally important to someone who seeks to oppose the Jews, as the Nazis did. And we can understand what they did that was effective. And I mentioned a little of that at the top of the show, but now we want to play a little more music. And I told you before we heard a nice Italian song, Cuore Ingrato. And I don't know what that means, but you probably got the sense of it from the song. Let's play. What should we play here? All right, we're going to play. We're going to play five songs now, and then we'll come back. We're going to start with Mountain Goats by No Children. Or maybe that's No Children by Mountain Goats, I think is what it is. We're going to play Self-Esteem by The Offspring. We're going to play Walking in L.A. by Missing Persons. Better Man by Pearl Jam. We're going to close it out with Beyond the Sea by Bobby Darin. And then we'll be back and we'll discuss homosexuals inside and outside the Nazi movement. Fascinating stuff. You're listening to Radio Estina. Here we go.
Up on trying to save us. I hope we come up with a fail-safe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. I hope the fences we mended fall down beneath their own weight, and I hope we hang on past the last exit. I hope it's already too late, and I hope the junkyard a few blocks from here someday burns down, and I hope the rising black smoke carries me far away, and I never come back. Tell everyone you were a good wife, and I hope you die. I hope we both die. hope I cut myself shaving tomorrow. I hope it bleeds all day long. Our friends say it's darkest before the sun rises. We're pretty sure they're all wrong. I hope it stays dark forever. I hope the worst isn't over. And I hope you blink before I do. I hope I never get sober. And I hope when you think of me years down the line, you can't find one good thing to say. And I'd hope that if I found the strength to walk out, you'd stay the hell out of my way. I am drowning. There is no sign of land. You are coming down with me. Hand in unlovable hand. And I hope you die. I hope we both die.
Thank you. watching the clock, it's 4 o'clock, it's got to stop. Tell him, take no more. She practices her speech as he opens the door. She rolls over, pretends to sleep as he looks her over. She lies and says she's in love with him, can't find a better man. She dreams in colors, she dreams in red, can't find a better man. Can't find a better man, can't find a better man. Oh.
Yeah. maybe we'll be beyond the sea. And never again I'll go
Beyond the Sea by Bobby Darin. Before that we heard Pearl Jam, Better Man. Walking in L.A. by Missing Persons. Self-Esteem by The Offspring. And No Children by Mountain Goats. And now, for the third and final segment of our show, we are going to touch upon a very interesting bit of history. One pregnant with meaning for Americois, the monstrous Jewish production. Very low production values, a cast of millions from the Third World. But this is information that you're not going to get from too many sources, and this is from an article that appeared in E. Michael Jones's magazine, Culture Wars, back in 1996. And he didn't write it. It was written by a guy named Scott Lively, who's the author of, the co-author of, The Pink Swastika. I don't have this book yet, but I'm going to get it and read the rest of what they have to say. But the essential claim here, as I said at the top of the show, is that Nazism in Germany was basically a highly fagotic production, in that before Nazism you had a youth movement dominated by rough, tough, seafaring homos who controlled the youth movement. They were pederasts, they were pro-Greek, they wanted to restore Greek Spartanic ideals. They dominated Nazism, and basically the Nazis were a homosexual gang, is almost what the guy's arguing. Now, what factual basis does he have for claiming this? Well, a fairly substantial one. I think you'll agree by the time that we're done. We'll probably go another hour on this and then wrap it up. And we'll do radio later this week at some point. It may also be in the wee hours. But let's see. Anyway, the title of the article is Homosexuality in the Nazi Party. And I came upon this doing a search after seeing they currently, right now, March 2008, we're recording this on March 12th, Wednesday, March 12th, 2008. And University of Rhode Island has a exhibit, I think it's put out by the Holocaust Museum there in D.C., but they have a specific touring exhibit of Nazi action versus homosexuals. And the truth is the Nazis did go after homosexuals, but it's also true that many in the Nazi hierarchy were themselves homosexuals, not just Ernst Röhm, but many others. And they were going after the Jew Magnus Hirschfeld, who was identified with cultural decadence in Weimar Germany, which turned the German people against the Jews for basically the first time. Germany had never been particularly... I remember a Jewish professor I had in college saying, you know, Germany was never noted for anti-Semitism. It was always Poland and France where anti-Semitism was much higher levels. It wasn't until Hitler that it really took off in Germany, which is an interesting thing. The Jews were... Well, they'd been in the German territory that became Germany in 1870 since a couple thousand years earlier. They'd come up from Rome and been traders in some of those towns. But anyway, it's enough for you to know that there are touring exhibits of what the Nazis did to the homosexuals. And this Nazi persecution of homosexuals, 1933 to 1945, is organized by the Holocaust Museum, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and you know they have the usual celebration of the decadent homosexual culture that you can find written about by Christopher Isherwood in his Berlin stories. And the stuff that you see in the movie Cabaret. Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, that clinking, clanking sound of money, 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 money. You've probably seen that. If not, you may want to check it out. A lot of people really don't. I actually like it pretty well. I think it really, Jewish as it is, it gets the difference between the big city, jaded, perverted, decadent, often homosexual Jewish culture and the clean, white, straight, pure Aryan rural culture. To polarize and make this divide, the Nazis sought, but in fact many of their top brawlers were faggots. Basically they were drunken, fighting, totally manly homosexuals, essentially. Well, let's see what Scott Lively has to say in his article that appeared in Culture Wars in 96. And Jones, in his book Libido Dominandi, which we've covered often last year before I took ill, we didn't get to Hirschfeld yet, but we'll cover him a little bit today. Part 2, Chapter 12. He has several pages that are basically about Magnus Hirschfeld, who's kind of the Jew, who's the central figure in all of this. In terms of he's starting a movement to get homosexuals' rights and fighting for it for 30 years from 1900 to 1933. And he's kind of identified with the decadence in Weimar. And certainly the Nazis identified him with the decadence and contrasted themselves. But meanwhile, offstage, people were coming together. Let's see here. So Jones covers the same territory as author Scott Lively covered in Jones's magazine in his book Libido Dominandi. So I gather you can get the story of the Nazis being homos in both the Pink Swastika and in Libido Dominandi to a lesser extent. E. Michael Jones says, recent sexual politics has found it expedient to expunge the truth about homosexual proclivities of the Nazis from the historical record. Can he back that up? We'll talk about his book in just a minute, but we'll talk about the Scott Lively article. So the point is that, you know, you've got the U.S. Holocaust Museum putting on a traveling display of how the Nazis hated the homos, but this covers up the fact that, in fact, many Nazis were homos, says Lively. And, you know, Americans are encouraged to recognize the pink triangle and to know what that means. Oh, it's like the Jewish star. You know, they're affixing it to all their enemies. They're rounding them up and sticking them in camps and killing them. But that's not really what happened. Just as with the Jews, they lie about what the Nazis did to the homosexuals, is his contention. And just as you'll see, it's kind of like, you know, saying the Republicans are anti-fag and they're pro-traditional values, but let's just say when they're in the stalls, they have a wide stance. Like the senator, right? Too many of them, apparently. Now, Lively says, in reality, Germany was the birthplace of gay rights, and its legacy in that nation is truly alarming. He says the grandfather of gay rights was a homo German lawyer named Karl Heinrich Ulrichs. Ulrichs, U-L-R-I-C-H-S, had been molested at age 14 by his male writing instructor. Instead of attributing his adult homosexuality to the molestation, however, Ulrichs devised in the 1860s, okay, while the Civil War is going on in the U.S., Ulrich devised in the 1860s what became known as the third sex theory of homosexuality. Ulrich's model holds that male homosexuals are actually female souls trapped in male bodies. Now, this becomes one of the two schools of what is the origin of homosexuality, and these two schools did battle, and the Nazi school came out on top, is what Lively is going to argue. And here's an interesting point for you etymologists out there. An early follower of Ulrichs, Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, coined the term homosexual in an open letter to the Prussian Minister of Justice in 1869. So that's where the term homosexual was created. Now remember again, we've talked about this in other Radio Astinas, the term racism was more or less coined by the Jew sexologist, founder of a study institute for the study of sex, Magnus Hirschfeld, we're going to talk about. He coined the term racism, or he was the first to launch it publicly. It may have been coined by one of the communists, but he was the first one to use it and really get it out there. So effectively, he invented it, according to an article Sam Francis wrote. But anyway, so this guy Ulrichs, a homo German lawyer, homosexual German lawyer who was molested as a kid, he coins the term homosexual, or one of his followers coins the term homosexual in 1869. What we're going to do is build up a little history here from roughly 1870 when the term was coined, 1869 up through when the Nazis take over and how they react. So we're talking a period of about 60 years here. You know, two-thirds of a century is the period we're going to cover, and we're going to talk about how the homos were intimately involved in the youth movement, like Boy Scouts in Germany and the Wandervogel, the Wandering Birds, and how that linked up to the army and the Freisoldaten. Germany wasn't allowed to have a giant army after World War One, so they had instead these, like, hey, we're free individuals who just happen to like to march down the street carrying guns, doing battle with the leftist Jew commies. So these homos and pederasts were all networked through the youth movement and through these Freisoldaten who defended Germany against the Judeo-communists, Judeo-Bolshevists, who took over some of the German cities like Bavaria, and they did away with them. And so it's a very, very interesting story they tell here, and I believe it's basically true because they use specific facts. If what they say is not true, then at least they are advancing falsifiable claims. The only problem I have with it on a couple of readings is that they rely on Jewish historians for some of the pertinent data, and that simply is not good enough because Jews lie. And they've told all kinds of different lies about Hitler, but we'll hear some of those. And we can decide if they really are lies or if they are factual. We needn't be afraid of anything that's actually true. Keep that in mind. So, Ulrich's follower coins the term homosexual. And this is going to take us a while. It may even take us a couple of hours, but that's all right. We got time. Early morning and no one's around. It's real quiet and it's nice. So, what we're going to do is trace the history of Nazism from the perspective of the queer. Now, Lively says, by the time Ulrichs died in 1895, the gay rights movement in Germany had gained considerable strength. Friedrich Engels noted this in a letter to Karl Marx regarding Ulrich's efforts. And they keep spelling this various ways, so I'm not sure if it's Ulrich with an H or Ulrichs ending in an S. But, so the two founders of communism are writing one to the other, Engels to Marx, quote, the pederasts start counting their numbers and discover they are a powerful group in our state. The only thing missing is an organization, but it seems to exist already, but it is hidden. Now, look, interesting things to note. One, the homos are already organizing before the turn of 1900. Two, Engels and Marx make no difference between fag and pederast. That is a distinction that today's homos insist upon. They grow quite hysterical if you point out that the priests who are called pedophiles are actually homos. So there's not a big difference here. Just like Ulrich was molested at 14, that's what the priests are doing. They're molesting like 12, 14-year-old boys. Is pedophile the right term for that? Well, fag is a better term for it in a lot of ways. And the point is that Ulrich wanted homosexual behavior to be decriminalized. So throughout this whole period, that's going to be a big push of the truly German faggots and the Jews who are working with them to try to decriminalize homosexuality, which is outlawed in Weimar under 175, paragraph 175. And that's what the battle will be over. The founding of the Sex Institute and the public lectures and the gay bars and the queer shit in Berlin, which is also the movie-making capital of the world, as Jones points out in his book. So you can imagine how decadent it was in Berlin. And remember, this is before all the Jews have been kicked out. And Berlin and Germany seem like a very hospitable place for Jews. And they create their own little milieu that's effectively pro-fag. Faggotry may not be criminalized, but the cops are basically looking the other ways, and that's how you get all the cabaret and the rest of that stuff. Now, so you've got Ulrich trying to, the father of gay rights, he's trying to decriminalize it. The term homosexual is coined in 1869. Lots of growing strength up until 1900. And, Lively says, he actually says, just as a preface, the gay rights movement in America often portrays itself as an American phenomenon which arose from the civil rights movement. So they try to make it sound like they came from the blacks. But he says, in fact, Germany is the birthplace of gay rights. So Ulrich's pressing for homosodomy to be decriminalized. One of his followers coins homosexual. Engels says, notes to Marx that the fags are organizing. And what Lively says is, after this Ulrich, the grandfather of gay rights, dies, the homo movement splits into two factions. One faction follows the Jew commie faggot Magnus Hirschfeld we've been talking about. The other one follows a guy named Adolf Brand, who together with some of his special friends formed the Community of the Special. Die Gemeinschaft der Eigenen, the Community of the special, right? So one thing on this way and we're going that way, but they're both ending up in someone's asshole, although they are two separate factions. So one strand is following the Jew Magnus Hirschfeld. This is the femme, the passive, the receivers, the pitchers, the tough guys are following Brand, Friedlander, and Jansen. And again, there's no racial or Jewish German split here. There's butch or there's femme among these male faggots at the turn of the century who are trying to decide how best to carry through their campaign to decriminalize their peculiar behaviors. And so the Brand faction versus the Hirschfeld faction. The Brand faction publishes a magazine called Der Eigene, the Special. Der Eigene, the Special. And they form the Community of the Special, and they publish a magazine, the Special. The Special. They think they're special. And Lively says, what divided these groups, these two different strands, was their concepts of masculinity. Ulrich's theory, you know, of a female soul trapped in a male body, those types, the grandfather of gay rights was a femme. He embraced, his theory embraced a feminine identity, and that's what Hirschfeld's strand carried on. They literally believed they were women trapped in men's bodies, according to Lively, Scott Lively, the writer of this. Followers of Brand, however, were deeply insulted by Ulrich's theory. They perceive themselves not merely as masculine, but as kind of hyper-masculine, as a breed of men superior in masculine qualities, even to heterosexuals. Let's just pause a minute and think about this. A lot of people, when they think of faggots, all they think of are, you know, flower shop, hairdresser, interior decorator types, but there's a different strand, and that is the super hyper-masculine leather types. I guess those are what you see on parade in San Francisco, and you know, like we saw the parade down in Australia, too. I posted that in the news thread there. So, homos aren't... I guess they can go two ways. They can be hyper-masculine and seek total anonymous, rough, brutal, uncaring sex. Or they can be more passive and more into the cultural side of things. But they're still men. At least the super-masculine ones are still men. And these really fetishize, you know, the development of the body and the Greek ideals and the certain types of haircut and certain types of looks. And you even see that today in homosexual subcultures, with obsession with bodybuilding and abdominal muscles and what have you, physical perfection. So he's saying that this strand is what ultimately, I don't know if it's right to say it became the Nazi Party, but yeah, it's pretty close to asserting that. There's a pretty damn good factual basis for saying that. You'll see as we get through this. Now, so you've got the weak side, the feminine side, following the Jew Hirschfeld, who's going to go on to write a book against racism and set up a sex institute, the latter before the former. The sex institute was formed very early in the century, and the book wasn't written until like the 30s. Anyway, but the other, the rough boys, the rough trade types, Adolf Brand, they're publishing their own magazine. They're forming their own committee or community, the community of the special, Gemeinschaft is community in German. And they're calling themselves special, and they're hyper-masculine. The community of the special, under Brand, asserted that male homosexuality was the foundation of all nation states. And that male homosexuals represented an elite strata of human society. The community of the special fashioned itself, or CS, fashioned itself as a modern incarnation of the warrior cults of ancient Greece. They're super fags. Modeling themselves after the military heroes of Sparta, Thebes, and Crete, members of the CS, the Committee of the Special, were ultra-masculine, male supremacist, and pederastic, that is, devoted to man-boy sex. Brand said in Der Eigene, that is, his magazine called The Special, that he wanted men who, quote, thirst for a revival of Greek times and Hellenic standards of beauty after centuries of Christian barbarism. The Christians and the Nazis like to trade insults like that. The Christians love, like Fleming, as we talked about earlier in the show, they love to accuse anybody who's not into classics and from a Mediterranean culture of being a northern primitive barbarian who needed to be civilized by Christianity, because there was no culture until Christians kicked in. That's not true. One of the keys, there's really little funnier than reading Fleming talking about these ancient Anglo-Saxons of the type whose myths congealed in Beowulf, because the warriors live by a code that is the antithesis of what these professional Catholics and culture preservers live by, which is always to be passive, meek, and mild, and turn the other cheek, and pretend that everybody but you isn't addressing the real problem, and basically walk away from stuff, whereas the other ones were more honor-bound, fighting. And they just had a manlier way of looking at things than the Christians had. So in return, the Christians denounced them. Just as they denounced modern Nazis, they denounced ancient white men living by white standards for being primitive barbarians. All it does is make being a primitive barbarian look pretty goddamn attractive. If the antithesis of that is some little library-bound feeb in Rockford, Illinois, my God, I'd rather be a barbarian. So we got two strands of homos here. One going off after Adolf Brand, hyper-masculine, the Special magazine, the members of the Special community. CS, community of the Special. they're going to recreate the warrior cult of ancient Greece. Whether they actually, those cults actually were cults, and whether they actually were made up of homosexuals as these people envision them, that's what they're saying. Neoclassical pederast warriors. Now Lively says, one of the keys to understanding both the rise of Nazism and the later persecution of some homosexuals by Nazis is found in this early history of the German gay rights movement. For it was the CS, the Community of the Special, which created and shaped what would become the Nazi persona. That's what I described, you know, the body and the strong jaw and the blue eyes and the cut hair and the hyper-masculine ethos. He's saying that this was the creation of one strand of the homosexual pro-gay rights movement, the Community of the Special. I hope you don't mind by being repetitive, because as this is somewhat new to me, I'm sure it's nearly entirely new to you listening. And if we go slow and we really ingrain it, we'll walk away with a fairly decent understanding of some of the origins of Nazi that heretofore have been obscured. I mean, God knows it's hard to find any straight facts about the Nazis. And there are things in what we're going to read that I find a little bit dubious, but Jones is generally reliable in my experience. Obviously, or I wouldn't spend hours... what was that word we used back in Honors English? Doing extremely close readings of texts. It starts with an E. I'll be goddamned, I can't think of it. Let's say we're excruciating them. That's not the right verb, but... anyway, it'll come to me later, but... I do that because I respect what he writes, so if he approves this article and puts it in his publication and says the same thing in Libido Dominandi, which we'll get to a little bit in a bit today, there's a good chance that it's factually based. And like Jefferson, there is no existing truth that we fear, whether about the Nazis or the Jews. So they're going to restore these ancient Greek cult warrior cults. Model, and as I said, the members of CS, he says, were ultra-masculine, male supremacist, and pederastic. And they wanted to revive the Greek times and Hellenic standards of beauty after centuries of Christian barbarism. And he says that one of the keys to understanding the rise of Nazism and the later persecution of some homosexuals by the Nazis, not all, some, is found in this early history of the gay rights movement in Germany. For it was the CS, the Community of the Special, which created and shaped what would become the Nazi persona. And it was the loathing which these butches held for effeminate homosexuals, or femmes, which led to the internment of some of the latter in slave labor camps in the Third Reich. So he's saying, yeah, they persecuted some homosexuals, but they only did the femme ones and the ones who were opposed to them. They didn't do their own kind. They left those alone. Now he has a subtitle, From Boy Scouts to Brown Shirts, and this will trace the rise of the youth movement in Germany as directed and basically founded and run by the fag movement. kind of a harbinger of what we may see here in the U.S. as they legalize, you know, faggotry and criminalize Boy Scouts. He says, Lively says, talk about a faggoty name. Scott Lively is a pretty faggoty name. The butch homosexuals of the CS transformed Germany. So these Committee of the Special Homos transformed Germany. Their primary vehicle was the German youth movement, known as the Wanderfuge, rovers or wandering youth, like what would be rangers in the British Isles, or Boy Scouts in the British Isles. Wanderfuge. Vogel is birds in Germany. Wander is like it is, like wanderlust, wandering. So you have this gay rights movement that's been developing for 30 years, and at the same time you have a youth movement. And the homos used the youth movement to advance their mission and their idea of themselves. In Central Europe, writes homosexual historian Parker Rossman, there was another effort to revive the Greek ideal of pedagogic pederasty in the movement of wandering youth. Ultimately, Hitler used and transformed the movement, expanding and building upon its romanticism as a basis for the Nazi Party. That is, these people are Germans, have a long tradition of walking. They have, you know, events where people just come together and, like a road race or something, they just walk. They might walk, you know, 10 kilometers through a forest. I can't remember the name of those things, but that kind of activity was the basis of a lot of German groups. And the Germans are famous for building different groups. So what they're saying is the homos used and transformed the youth movement into a kind of Nazi precursor, and that became the basis of the SA. And they picked Hitler because he was so good at what he did to kind of run the thing as it formed up in the 20s. So over these 20 years from, you know, 1900 to 1920, the youth movement is developing. You've got the World War that's, and you've got these Freisoldaten coming back and this whole mix of things in very disturbed times when Germany is subject to pressure either way from the commies in the east and from the loans in the west that are being demanded of them. It all comes together in Hitler and the Nazi Party, these different trends. But he says, rising spontaneously in the 1890s as an informal hiking and camping society, so like Boy Scouts, the Wandervogel became an official organization at the turn of the century, similar to the Boy Scouts. From early on, however, the Wandervogel was dominated and controlled by the pederasts of the CS, the Committee of the Special. So, 1890, this German Boy Scout deal is formed, the Wandervogel, and it becomes an official organization, whatever that means, at 1900. But from early on, it's controlled and dominated by faggots, by pederasts of the butch strand of the homosexual movement in Germany, the movement for gay rights. CS co-founder Wilhelm Janssen, J-A-N-Z-E-N, Committee of the Special co-founder Janssen was its chief benefactor, and its leadership was rife with homosexuality. And you got to remember that Germans are just like America. The basic stock of America is German. It's not even British, it's German. And they don't like that stuff. They don't like homosexuality. They don't like immorality or decadence. And yet this was going on in Germany. So, okay, so the Wandervogel arise up in 1890 to 1900. They're more formalized, and they're dominated by the Committee of the Special, these butch pederasts and faggots who want to restore these ancient Greek warrior cults. And the activities of the Wandervogel are, you know, physical primarily. They're out hiking and hunting and running around and camping and all kinds of things, Boy Scout type things. And so the chief benefactor, whatever that means, of the Wandervogel is one of these CS fags, Committee of the Specials, Janssen. In 1912, CS theorist Hans Blücher wrote, "The German Wandervogel movement as an erotic phenomenon," which told how the organization was used to recruit young boys into homosexuality. And see, that's the thing. They say, oh, we don't recruit, but they do recruit. Because humans are very suggestible, and homosexuality might be other things, but it can be an acquired taste or behavior, just as the grandfather of gay rights was drawn into it by being molested when he was 14, and this sets up certain psychological patterns in a certain percentage of the people it happens to, where they need that thing again, and fags know that, and they like the firm young skin of these people, so they go after them. So whoever boys are, that's where you're going to find these pederasts. So, Committee of the Special theorist is writing, you know, publications like this, basically NAMBLA type stuff. The German Wandervogel movement as an erotic phenomenon, which told how the organization was used to recruit young boys into homosexuality. Now, I don't know how stuff like that is allowed to pass in the Germany of that time. Wandervogel youths were indoctrinated with Greek paganism and taught to reject the Christian values of their parents, who were mostly Catholics and Lutherans. The Committee of the Special Belief, the CS Belief in a Homosexual Elite, took shape within the von der Vogel in the concept of der Führer, the leader. E.Y. Hartshorn, in German Youth and Nazi Dream of Victory, records the recollections of a former von der Vogel member in this regard. The former member of the von der Vogel says, quote, "We little suspected then what power we had in our hands. We played with a fire that had set a world in flames, and it made our hearts hot. It was in our ranks that the word Führer originated, with its meaning of blind obedience and devotion. And I shall never forget how in those early days we pronounced the word Gemeinschaft, or community, with a trembly, throaty note of excitement, as though it hid a deep secret." So they're talking about a community, and they're talking about a leader. And these boys are being trained up, and one thing that the left knows is that the youth are easily inflamed in their moral passions, and they can be properly channeled, or they can be mischanneled, as they are today. So that they're mischanneled at Truman State in a way of, you know, these kids will write an article about these itinerant niggers who are trying to found some barbecue place in Kirksville, and, oh, how can we students at Truman State help them grow a business so they don't have to move around, they can have an actual shop. So the youth can be misled and seduced in a number of different ways because they're young and they don't know and they're full of energy and idealism. And the Committee of the Special in Germany is leading them into pederasty and into neo-Greek warrior cults, is what Scott Lively is arguing. And you would have to go to Germany and be in Germany to see what it's like. It's not like Americans who speak German. They actually are a real nation. That is, they're related. So there's more of a family feeling, which is certainly being undermined by open... They don't have open borders there, but they have lots of invasion. Again, they're, you know, 1/50th the size of the U.S. They're as big as maybe Oregon or Washington. They got 80 million people in there, so... There's more of a community feel inherently there than there ever is in America, where it's tied by money more than anything else. Money is the common denominator in America. So we see in the von der Vogel, which is dominated by these pederasts, the development of the leadership principle and the idea of an elite community. And you feel, man, I'm really part of something. Where does a young man in America, what does he ever feel part of? What larger thing does he feel part of? There really isn't anything. I mean, at work, he's encouraged to take the side of the minority, and often his salary or even his promotions are tied to how he treats minorities, so-called. He's never allowed to join his own group of his own kind and advance their interests. So he's separated from the broader community. Well, that was not the case here, even if it was led by these pederasts and these homos. They were still pro-German. But he's saying the leadership principle, the Führer principle, and obedience to it, and devotion to the community and to its leader, developed in the von der Vogel, led by these Committee of Special Homosexuals. Louis Snyder, who's probably a Jew, in the Encyclopedia of the Third Reich, said that the Führer principle became identical with the elite principle. The Führer elite were regarded as independent of the will of the masses. Snyder was not writing about the Gemeinschaft, the community of the der eigenen, the committee of the community of the special, or of the von der Vogel, but of the upper ranks of the Nazi Party some 30 years later. Another Nazi custom from the von der Vogel was a Sieg Heil salute, which was an early form of greeting popular among the wandering youth. During World War I, the greatest hero of the German youth movement was Gerhard Rosbach, R-O-S-S-B-A-C-H, described by historian Robert G.L. Waite as a, quote, sadist, murderer, and homosexual, unquote. Rosbach was the most important single contributor of the pre-Hitler youth movement. More important, Rosbach was the bridge between the von der Vogel and the Nazi Party. Okay, so we've got the von der Vogel, rising in 1890, formalizing in 1900, led by the fags from the Committee of the Special, which is the butch faction of the homosexuals, who publish their own magazine and have their form their own committee and dominate the Wandervogel. And in this Wandervogel, they are encouraging pederasty, and they're coming up with the Führer principle and the Sieg Heil and the formation of a warrior cult of elite who are better than others and who form the elite who are going to lead society. And then the connection from this Wandervogel to the Nazi party is this guy named Gerhard Rosbach. And they're saying that during World War I, he was considered the greatest hero of the German youth movement, but a historian calls him a sadist, a murderer, and a homosexual. And that, now listen, this is how it works, and you've got to understand that World War I, right, which is ending, you know, 1919, was a very demoralizing war. Literally demoralizing. It rips away the morals of people, and they're used to seeing killing, and life is cheap, and war always has that effect. It mixes people forcibly, throws things up. It gets rid of traditional settled morals just by its very nature of upheaval. And so after this war, and you got to remember, you've had the communists, the Jewish communists, the Jewish Bolsheviks take power over in the USSR, which is, you know, 1,000 miles from Germany. It's not that far away, across the Polish plain. And then Germany, having lost the war, although never having had a foreign soldier on its soil at the time it conceded defeat, has to pay billions and billions and billions of reparations to the West. Very harsh punishment, and it's not allowed to have more than 100,000 troops. So, in these turbulent days, Lively picks up, following Germany's defeat in World War I, Gerhard Rosbach, who he's saying is the link between the Wandervogel youth movement, dominated by homos, and the formal Nazi party, Gerhard Rosbach was one of many former army officers placed in command of the Freikorps, or Freikorps units. These unofficial auxiliary military units were designed to circumvent limitations imposed on German troop strength by the Allies. So formally, the Germans are not allowed to have more than 100,000 in their army. So the Freikorps is the way they get around that. And Gerhard Rosbach, the link between the youth movement and the Nazis, is one of the officers in command of the Freikorps, the Freikorps units. Rosbach organized a Freikorps called Rosbach's Sturmabteilung. How about that? Rosbach's Stormtroopers. Now think where you're going to see stuff. So all these things are coming. Okay, we've got this. We've got the Sieg Heil coming from the Wandervogel. We've got the Führer principle. We've got the community of the elect. We've got the Sturmabteilung from Rosbach's Freikorps unit. Rosbach also built the largest post-war youth organization in Germany, named the Schiljugend, Schill Youth, S-C-H-I-L-L. It was some guy, a famous Prussian soldier, he says. So Schill Youth is formed after the war. In The Black Corps, a book by historian Robert Lewis Cole notes that both Rosbach's stormtroopers and the Schiljugend, like the Hitler Jugend, think of that. Jugend means youth in Germany, like boy youth. Schiljugend were notorious for wearing brown shirts, which had been prepared for German colonial troops acquired from the old Imperial Army stores. Remember that Germany was late to the colonization of Africa, and apparently its colonists, German East Africa and such, wore brown shirts. So you have yet another staple of the Nazi persona or outfit. You have their gesture, flat upraised 45-degree angled palm, Sieg Heil. You've got the Führer principle. You've got the brown shirts. And it's all starting to come together. These stormtroopers would soon become known as Nazi brown shirts. Now, I'm not sure what the relation is here between the Schiljugend and the Wandervogel. But Lively says that Rosbach's Schiljugend was the largest post-war youth organization in Germany. Presumably, a lot of the boys who were in the Wandervogel ended up going off to war. And then they come back, and they're in the Freikorps that's commanded by people like Rossbach, who then sets up the Schiljugend after the war. So 20 years of von der Vogel, where they're getting down some of this Hitlerian practices and beliefs under the tutelage and under the dicks of these pederasts from the Committee of the Special. Then you have a war, teaches them how to fight, then they come back and society's in turmoil, and the commies have taken over in Russia, and the money is leaving Germany, and foreign troops are in Germany, and the commies are trying to take over in Germany, and this is the situation. It's a real welter. It's a real mix. And so he says these stormtroopers would soon become the Rossbach stormtroopers, Sturmabteilung, Storm Division, would soon become known as Nazi brownshirts. Konrad Haydn, a contemporary of Hitler and a leading authority on Nazi history, wrote that the Freikorps, the Free Corps, were breeding places of perversion, unquote, and that Rossbach's troop was especially proud, unquote, of being homosexual. Rossbach's adjutant was Edmund Heines, H-E-I-N-E-S, noted for his ability to procure boys for sexual orgies. Ernst Röhm, recruited by Rossbach into homosexuality, later commanded the stormtroopers for the Nazis, where they were more commonly known as the SA, an acronym for Sturmabteilung. Now remember, Rossbach, leading the Freikorps, and he's being called a sadist, murderer, and homosexual. And he's saying that this is the guy who not only set up the largest movement after the war, he's commanding Freikorps troops, he's creating the Schiljugend, the Schiljuth, he's recruited into homosexuality by Rossbach, apparently, or so they're claiming. And Röhm is the guy who sets up the SA for Hitler, and the SA has a large multiple of what the formal army has in terms of numbers, and Röhm is a blazing homosexual. So it's all coming together, the dress, the gestures, the thinking, the practices, the behavior, all coming together. The Power Behind the Throne is the next subtitle. While Adolf Hitler is today recognized as the central figure of Nazism, he was a less important player when the Nazi machine was first assembled. Its first leader was Ernst Röhm. Homosexual historian Frank Rechter writes that Hitler was, to a substantial extent, Röhm's protege. Röhm had been a captain in the German army. Hitler had been a mere corporal. After World War I, Röhm was highly placed in the underground nationalist movement, and it's underground because it has to be kind of illegal because Germany lost the war. After World War I, Röhm was highly placed in the underground nationalist movement that plotted to overthrow the Weimar government and worked to subvert it through assassinations and terrorism. So you've got these homosexual terrorist soldiers who are fighting to get rid of Weimar that's imposed on them, the Weimar democracy, after Germany loses World War I. And at this time, Röhm is more important than Hitler, they're asserting. In The Order of the Death's Head, author Heinz Hoene writes that Röhm met Hitler at a meeting of the socialist terrorist group called the Iron Fist, and, quote, saw in Hitler the demagogue he required to mobilize mass support for his secret army. So these demobilized soldiers, these Freikorps, who are going through the streets and protecting Germany from the Jewish communists who are trying to stage a revolution there, as they've just carried off in Russia, are led by Ernst Röhm, and he sees in Hitler the demagogue or the successful democratic politician who can sell his secret army to the masses through overt and respectable political channels. Röhm, who had joined the German Workers' Party before Hitler, worked with him to take over the fledgling organization. With Röhm's backing, Hitler became the first president of the party in 1921 and changed its name to the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Soon after Rossbach's stormtroopers, the SA became its military arm. So Rossbach recruits Röhm into homosexuality and sets him up as more or less the head of the SA, and Röhm picks Hitler to head the German Workers' Party, and they rename it, and then they bring the SA in, and boom, they've really got something. The SA is the military arm of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. In his classic Nazi history, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which has lies in it, author William Shirer, who is a Jew, describes Rome as a stocky, bull-necked, piggish-eyed, scar-faced professional soldier, and like so many of the early Nazis, a homosexual. Rector writes, and Rector is a homosexual historian who wrote that Hitler was to a substantial extent Rome's protege. Rector writes, was not the most outstanding, most notorious of all homosexuals the celebrated Nazi leader Ernst Röhm, the virile and manly chief of the SA, the do-buddy of Adolf Hitler. That means he is on informal terms with him. German is either formal or informal, and you use the informal do only with tight friends and intimates or children or dogs. Everybody else used C. So, was he not the virile and manly chief of the SA, the do-buddy of Adolf Hitler from the beginning of his political career? Hitler's rise had in fact depended upon Rome, and everyone knew it. Rome's gay fun and games were certainly no secret. His amorous forays to gay bars and gay Turkish baths were riotous. Whatever anti-homosexual sentiments may have been expressed by straight Nazis were more than offset by the reality of highly visible, spectacular, gay-loving Rome. Rum is how it's actually pronounced. If there were occasional ominous rumblings and grumblings about, quote, all those queers, unquote, in the SA and movement, and some anti-gay flare-ups, homosexual Nazis felt more or less secure in the lap of the party. After all, the National Socialist Party member who wielded the greatest power, aside from Hitler, was Rum himself. Betraying his roots in the Butch faction of the German gay rights movement, that's the Committee of the Special, and the people who dominated the Wanderfogel, Brand and Jansen and a couple others had their own magazine and their Committee of the Special, Community of the Special. Betraying his roots in the Butch faction of the German gay rights movement, Röhm viewed homosexuality as the basis for a new society. Lewis Snyder writes that Röhm projected a social order in which homosexuality would be regarded as a human behavior pattern of high repute. He flaunted his homosexuality in public and insisted that his cronies do the same. What was needed, Röhm believed, was a proud and arrogant lot who could brawl, carouse, smash windows, kill and slaughter for the hell of it. Straights, in his eyes, were not as adept in such behavior as practicing homosexuals. Now that may sound fanciful until you think of like the San Francisco parades. The guy strutting around practically naked and flaunting it and you know, they want everybody to look at them. Give that a political twist. It needn't necessarily be leftist. I mean, there's very little more totalitarian than queers, because if they have any chance, they will absolutely stamp out any criticism of themselves or anything on their agenda, just like Jews will. The principal function of this army-like organization, writes historian Thomas Fuchs, was beating up anybody who opposed the Nazis, and Hitler believed this was a job best undertaken by homosexuals. I don't know what the basis of that belief is, or why he asserts that. The favorite meeting place of the SA, the Sturmabteilung, the stormtroopers, was a gay bar in Munich called the Bratwurstglockel, where Röhm kept a reserved table. This was the same tavern where some of the earliest formative meetings of the Nazi Party had been held. At the Bratwurstglockel, Röhm and associates Edmund Heinz, Karl Ernst, Ernst partner Captain Rohrbein, Captain Petersdorf, Count Ernst Heldorf, and the rest would meet to plan and strategize. These were the men who orchestrated the Nazi campaign of intimidation and terror. All of them were homosexual, according to Haydn. Indeed, homosexuality was all that qualified many of these men for their positions in the SA. Heinrich Himmler would later complain of this. Does it not constitute a danger to the Nazi movement if it can be said that Nazi leaders are chosen for sexual reasons? He said, Himmler was not so much opposed to homosexuality itself as to the fact that non-qualified people were given high rank based on their homosexual relations with Röhm and others. For example, SA Obergruppenführer, Lieutenant General Karl Ernst, a militant homosexual, had been a hotel doorman and a waiter before joining the SA. Carl Ernst is not yet 35, writes Gallo. He commands 250,000 men. He is simply a sadist, a common thug, transformed into a responsible official. This strange brand of nepotism was a hallmark of the SA. By 1933, when Hitler took power, the SA had grown far larger than the German army, yet the Viking Corps, officers' corps, remained almost exclusively homosexual. Rome is the head of a 2,500,000 man stormtroops, writes historian H.R. Knickerbocker, had surrounded himself with a staff of perverts. His chiefs, men of rank of Gruppenführer or Obergruppenführer, commanding units of several hundred thousand stormtroopers, were almost without exception homosexuals. Indeed, unless a stormtroop officer were a homosexual, he had no chance of advancement. That's an interesting assertion. They're saying the upper ranks of the Nazi private army were all homosexuals, or very, very close to it. In the essay, The Community of the Specials, Hellenic ideal of masculine homosexual supremacy and militarism was fully realized. Theirs was a very masculine brand of homosexuality, writes homosexualist historian Alfred Rouse, or Rose, R-O-W-S-E. They lived in a male world without women, a world of camps and marching, rallies and sports. They had their own relaxations, and the Munich essay became notorious on account of them. The similarity of the essay to Friedlander and Brand's dream of Hellenic revival is not coincidental. Now, Friedlander and Brand are the guys who are founding the Butch strain of gay rights that carries on from Ulrichs when he passes, as opposed to Magnus Hirschfeld and the Femme Judeo stream. In Gay American History, Jonathan Katz writes that Rome was a prominent member of the Society for Human Rights, an offshoot of this committee of the special, or the community of the special. So, well, that's just interesting. Society for Human Rights is an offshoot of the community of the special, which is an organization formed by the Butch faction of the gay rights movement in Germany, the turn of the century, last century. The relaxation to which Rouser refers were, of course, the homosexual activities, many of them pederastic, for which the SA and the CS were both famous, the stormtroopers and the community of the special. Hohner writes that Rome used the SA for ends other than the purely political. Peter Graninger, who had been one of Rome's partners, was now given cover in the SA intelligence section. For a monthly salary of 200 marks, he kept Rome supplied with new friends, his main hunting ground being the Geisela High School, Munich. From this school he recruited no fewer than 11 boys, whom he first tried out and then took to Rome. So these pederasts are kind of grooming their young male partners. Next subtitle, Hitler's Gay Roots. In 1945, a Jewish historian, that is a liar, by the name of Samuel Igra, published Germany's National Vice, a book which called homosexuality the poison stream that ran through the heart of Nazism. This is published in 1945 again. A book by a Jew named Igra, I-G-R-A, published a book called Germany's National Vice. Talk about homosexuality and Nazism. In the 1920s and 30s, homosexuality was known as the German vice, unquote, across Europe because of the debaucheries of the Weimar period. Igra, who escaped Germany in 1939, claims that Hitler, quote, had been a male prostitute in Vienna at the time of his sojourn there from 1907 to 1912, and that he practiced the same calling in Munich from 1912 to 1914, unquote. Desmond Seward, in Napoleon and Hitler, says Hitler is listed as a homosexual in Viennese police records. That's an interesting and highly falsifiable assertion. Either the police records exist or they don't, and if they do exist, then they show whether or not that's true. Lending credence to this is the fact, noted by Walter Langer, that during several of those years Hitler, quote, chose to live in a Viennese flophouse known to be inhabited by many homosexuals, unquote. Rector writes that, as a young man, Hitler was often called der schöne Adolf, the handsome Adolf, and then later his looks, quote, were also to some extent helpful in gaining big money support from Ernst Röhm's circle of wealthy gay friends. So this is anecdotal or circumstantial, or Jew historian provided evidence that Hitler was either a male prostitute or came out of that environment. Langer, a psychiatrist, was commissioned by the Allies in 1943 to prepare a thorough psychological study of Hitler. In 1943, that is. His report, kept under wraps for 29 years, was published in a book form in 1972 as The Mind of Adolf Hitler. Langer writes that Hitler was certainly a coprophile, a person who is sexually aroused by human excrement, and may have practiced homosexuality as an adult. He cites the testimony of Hermann Rauschning, a former Hitler confidant, who, quote, reports he has met two boys who claim they were Hitler's homosexual partners, but their testimony can hardly be taken at face value. More condemning, adds Langer, would be the remarks dropped by Albert Forster, the Danzig Gauleiter, in a conversation with Rauschning. Even here, however, the remarks deal only with Hitler's impotence as far as heterosexual relationships go, without actually implying that he indulges in homosexuality. It is probably true that Hitler calls Förster Bubi, which is a common nickname employed by homosexuals in addressing their partners, B-U-B-I. This alone is not adequate proof that he has actually indulged in homosexual practices with Förster, who is known to be a homosexual, unquote, Langer. However, writes Langer, even today Hitler derives sexual pleasure from looking at men's bodies and associating with homosexuals. Two, Hitler's greatest hero was Frederick the Great, a well-known homosexual. Now, you know, who knows, this psychiatrist is almost certainly a Jew, Walter Langer, and he's writing at the behest of the U.S. government, which is even then fairly dominated by Jews, so who knows. I would say this is more dubious than the other stuff about Rome and his circle, which seems to be pretty well factually substantiated. Like Langer, Waite, historian Waite, also hesitates to label Hitler a homosexual, but cites substantial circumstantial evidence that he was. It is true that Hitler was closely associated with Ernst Röhm and Rudolf Hess, two homosexuals who were among the very few people with whom he used the familiar "du." But one cannot conclude there that he therefore shared his friend's sexual taste. Still, during the months he was with Hess in Landsberg, their relationship must have become very close. When Hitler left the prison, he fretted about his friend who languished there and spoke of him tenderly, using Austrian diminutives. Ach, mein Rudi, mein Hesserl. Isn't it appalling to think that he's still there? One of Hitler's valets, Schneider, made no explicit statement about the relationship, but he did find it strange that whenever Hitler got a present he liked or drew an architectural sketch that particularly pleased him, he would run to Hess, who is known in homosexual circles as Fräulein Anna, as a little boy would run to his mother to show his prize to her. Finally, there is the non-conclusive but interesting fact that one of Hitler's prized possessions was a handwritten love letter which King Ludwig II had written to a manservant. Hitler, if homosexual, was certainly not exclusively so. There are at least four women, including his own niece, with whom Hitler had sexual relationships, although these relationships were not normal. Both Waite and Langer suggest that his sexual encounters with women evidence that he was. It is true that Hitler was closely associated with Ernst Röhm and Rudolf Hess, two homosexuals who were among the very few people with whom he used the familiar "du." But one cannot conclude there that he therefore shared his friend's sexual taste. Still, during the months he was with Hess in Landsberg, their relationship must have become very close. When Hitler left the prison, he fretted about his friend who languished there and spoke of him tenderly, using Austrian diminutives. Ach, mein Rudi, mein Hesserl. Isn't it appalling to think that he's still there? One of Hitler's valets, Schneider, made no explicit statement about the relationship, but he did find it strange that whenever Hitler got a present he liked or drew an architectural sketch that particularly pleased him, he would run to Hess, who is known in homosexual circles as Fräulein Anna, as a little boy would run to his mother to show his prize to her. Finally, there is the non-conclusive but interesting fact that one of Hitler's prized possessions was a handwritten love letter which King Ludwig II had written to a manservant. Hitler, if homosexual, was certainly not exclusively so. There are at least four women, including his own niece, with whom Hitler had sexual relationships, although these relationships were not normal. Both Wade and Langer suggest that his sexual encounters with women...